meeting of the portfolio committee on private industry,
where we'll be looking at the three entities, where we're going to discuss the strategic plans of the three entities. That is, the first one will be the National Consumer Commission, followed by the Company and Intellectual Property Commission, and the last one, but not the least, which is the National Credit Regulator. So we're having all these entities here today, knowing very well that it is a committee week this week, so it is business as usual for Parliament. So that's why I'd like to welcome everyone in, the members of Parliament in particular, because we know that you never rest. Over the weekend to organize all these matches and all these things, which are not supposed to be doing. All these meetings and all these conferences. We know that you've got a hectic schedule. So that's why we appreciate it that you are committed to the transformation of the country. So I'd like to welcome each and everyone in this meeting, in particular the members of Parliament, the representatives from the various entities which are invited here today. Also the members of the public, because as we're doing our work, we're doing it for the public in general. So we appreciate that they always have this interest of following the work of the portfolio committee or on trade and industry. So as you know very well, that the chairperson of the committee is not in today. She is in Brussels, where she's doing parliamentary work. It's not private work, it's parliamentary work, where she's representing the Parliament of the Republic when they meet with the EU parliamentarians. So there are a lot of stuff which affect this committee, which are being dealt with there. So that's why I'm honored for this day to chair this meeting and hope that everyone will participate freely. So we are having a few apologies. As I said, that the first one was that of Ms. Jaffer, who is in parliamentary business in Brussels. Number two is that one of Mr. McIntosh. She's with the portfolio committee in Russia. And the other one is that of Mr. G. Hill Lewis, who's got party commitments in George. He indicated that last week before he left. So I think these apologies are the ones that are noted and accepted, because they are. Is there any other apology which we are missing? Yes, Mr. Ross?
No, I apologize that I will move between two committees today, EDD as well as trade and industry, because there is confusion. Certain information says it's a constituency period, then the whip says the committee week. So what I will do, I will move between the two committees today. Thanks.
All right, Honourable Mabaso, but just to clarify this thing, it is a committee week this week. It is a committee week this week. So since it is a committee week, what will happen is that the morning slot is for the trading industry. But I think that the secretary to the committee can explain that.
The parliamentary program may indicate constituency week, but that's changed to a committee week, and it was agreed to at the program committee meeting of the National Assembly, approved by the House Chairperson and the Chief Whip. So it's a committee week today. So if your program indicates constituency week, it is a committee week, and all rules apply in terms of committee activities.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary and the Emmons. All right, without a waste of time, we've got the representatives from the Commission. That is the National Consumer Commissioner, Mayor Musala, and the CFO of the Commission, Manto, and the Information and Commission Technology Director. Who's that? He's not here.
From the finance department as well.
So, and then we're also having the representatives from the department. I can see Mr. Nishitan there, Mr. Naido, everyone who will be there, and Ms. Naido is in the CCSF. And then I think that will participate accordingly.
So I will give the commission the chance now to present the strategic plan.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members. It's our pleasure to, for the second time, come through and present our strategic plan for the period 2012 to 2017. I will just reiterate our vision, mission, and values, and then I will go into the strategic goals and objectives, then we will deal with the issue of the budget. And I think that will then complete the presentation from the National Consumer Commission. Our vision is to create a well-resourced, responsive, and leading institution in consumer protection. From a mission point of view, we plan to promote, protect, advance the socio-economic welfare of consumers in South Africa by providing leadership, advocacy, and a critical system of rapid redress, thereby creating a fair and accessible consumer marketplace. Honourable Members, you'll note that our mission is a mirror reflection of what we presented to the committee last year, and we believe that when we're given the opportunity to come and present our annual report, we'll actually be able to demonstrate that we've really been able to live up to what has been espoused in the mission of the Commission in the first financial year of our operation. The values of the Commission still stay the same. To promote and maintain a high standard of professional ethics, we believe we actually do exhibit a very high professional ethical standard in the work that we do. We are there to also promote an efficient, effective, and economic use of resources. We also believe we've risen to the occasion on this specific value. To provide service impartially, fairly, effectively, and without bias. We believe that we've also met this. In fact, we believe that we've met all the values that we've espoused in relation to our report. But I think the one that's very important that we believe that is, despite many challenges we've been able to meet, is to promote broad public participation in the work that we do. In fact, I think it's important for me to just highlight that last week Thursday was World Consumer Day, and we actually had a panel discussion where we invited consumers to actually give us an assessment of whether or not there has been a change in relation to the rights of consumers from in the 12 months that the Consumer Commission has been in existence. And we'd like to report to this committee that we've actually received a very supportive report from consumers. In fact, virtually all of them who are present were very pleased with the work that the Commission is doing, and they feel that there has been a drastic change in their life, both directly and indirectly, due to the existence of the Commission and the work that the Commission has done. If members would like me to give them more detail, I'm more than willing to do so during the question and answer section. The strategic goal and objective is to protect consumers from habits through advocacy, education, and awareness. The second strategic objective and goal is to improve consumer redress as investors in the Consumer Protection Act. The third is to protect consumers from unethical business practices and misconduct through law enforcement and compliance. The fourth one is to conduct research for policy, legislative, and regulatory improvement. The fifth one is the achievement of consumer and stakeholder expectations as well as those of standing advisory committees. The sixth is to ensure the establishment of a functional organization. Seven, to achieve the mandate of the NCC with an optimal staff complement. Eight, implement an organization-wide performance management system. Nine, to create the brand of the NCC as a voice for South African consumers. Ten, to provide an effective ICT infrastructure and network. 11, to implement effective and efficient financial management system. Now I'm going to go into the detail of the specific strategic goals and objectives that I've outlined above. I think what's important to speak to is really the performance indicators, because they speak to the specific projects and activities that the Commission would actually have put in place in order to give to ensure that we comply with the strategic goals and outcomes. Specifically with regards to the advocacy and strategic goal and outcomes, the first initiative that we believe is critical and we actually are going to put in place is to make sure that we have a number of schemes for consumer protection to be assessed online and in print. Specifically, what we're going to do is we're going to extract the different rights of consumers as espoused in terms of the Consumer Protection Act. Then we'll go out, create awareness around those specific rights, give practical examples to consumers, conduct the necessary information sharing sessions to make sure that consumers actually understand the rights in a practical sense of the word in relation to the application of the Consumer Protection Act. We also intend on having a number of consumer workshops, conferences, and even diesels. This is an activity that really we've already started in this in the 2011-2012 financial year, in terms of which we've gone out, we've had diesels in different provinces, we've had workshops, we've had public hearings. It's not actually public holidays, it's actually public hearings. And we've also had, we had also intended to have one conference that we've had to carry over. So in the 2012, during the strategic period of the 5-year period, we will obviously be holding a number of workshops. We'll continue with the formula of the measles because we feel that it has actually yielded a result in that we've been able to actually access rural consumers. We do expect that finances permitting, that we will hold a regional conference because we had intended on actually having a regional conference within the static region because we think it's critical that we speak to our counterparts within the region around issues of consumer protection so that consumer protection stops being the step cousin of competition but actually takes its place on the center stage because currently you find that consumer protection really is relegated to the back seats. And we believe that once we have a static conference, then we'll start to get the decision makers to start considering consumer protection as a key and critical tool with regard to making sure that our citizens actually get better value in relation to their livelihoods and their economic activity. We also have included initiatives around making sure that we speak to young people at an early age around issues of consumer protection in their rights. We'll be approaching 2 schools and 2 tertiary institutions per year in order to educate around issues of consumer protection and hopefully build long-lasting relationships around consumer protection and making sure that these are included in the curriculum and the syllabuses. We'll also be approaching consumer clubs. In the past financial year, we actually picked up that we're invited by a lot of consumer clubs, mainly your body corporates and your stock sales. We wanted to obviously be educated around issues of consumer protection. We actually want to continue with this work because we believe that the reach of such clubs is very wide and is very important for the work that we'll do. We also intend on just having your general outreach programs as and when we are called upon in order to add value to the workings of the different entities that call upon us as the Commission to give them information. We also wanted to intend on preparing reports in relation to the findings that we make around different areas of advocacy and comments that we believe are useful for consumers to utilize going forward. Things like the most commonly asked questions around consumer protection or the Consumer Protection Act, that's what is in this is in relation to these reports. You will see that we start off in this financial year, we've only dealt with one, but we expect that in 2012, 2013, right up to 2017, we'll be dealing with 4 reports escalating it up to 8 reports. With regard to the next strategic goal, which is complaint handling system, the first measure there is that of the percentage of the consumer complaints that will be timely resolved. We initially had a 90-95% baseline, but we've noted that because of budgetary constraints, we haven't been able to actually increase the staff complement to the extent that we'd like to. So we've now come with a more conservative target of 60%, which we believe is more realistic under the circumstances. And we do believe, obviously, the number of complaints will be growing as time goes on. So we believe that we'll be able to deal with 60% of the complaints resolve 60% of the complaints when they're presented to the Commission. And then we obviously intend on also having a consumer satisfaction index. And this will obviously deal with the number of consumer practitioners that will obviously be accredited in the provinces. So we expect that per year we'll accredit 3 consumer protection practitioners within the provinces who will not only make sure that they spread the word around consumer protection, but they're on the ground in relation to the work that the Consumer Commission does and will obviously be able to help us with our assessment around consumer satisfaction with regard to the work that the Commission does. We'll also be dealing with complaints and matters received and finalized using CPA enforcement tools. What we're basically talking to here is the number of compliance notices that we issue and the number of consent agreements that we issue. We obviously, as a baseline, we're looking at 45%, but in the 2012-2013 financial year, we're looking at increasing that to 75% and increasing that over the 5-year period to 97%. With regard to the strategic goal of enforcement and compliance, we felt that we want to continue with the model that we basically adopted in the first financial year, which is identifying 3 industries for investigation. And you will see that really this is a methodology that we'll be using across the board over the 5-year period, whereby we identify 3 areas we investigate compliance with the Consumer Protection Act, and where we believe that there's a need for interventions, we will then obviously put in place the relevant interventions. We also will be dealing with issues of the percentage of investigated complaints or cases that are successfully settled through litigation. We do find that there are quite a number of matters that are being litigated on by the Commission. And there are some that we obviously settle before they actually get to trial, but there are those that have, well, I think we have two that goes that have gone the whole way to trial and have obviously been able to successfully settle them. So we're looking towards ensuring that we settle these matters at the rate of 60% without them actually being reaching the fully blown stage of actually being presented before a judge. With regard to Measure 3.3, we will also be looking at the percentage of investigative complaints timelessly finalized, which obviously would not go through litigation, but they will be finalized after the investigations are conducted within the Commission. We're looking at settling these matters at 70% of those that are referred to investigations within that particular period or within that financial year, and this would obviously increase to 95% of the complaints over the 5-year period. Because we believe that within that period we'll have better understanding of the provisions of the Act, the interpretation of the Act, and the application of the Act. And further, we believe that as we conduct more and more investigations, we'll start to create precedent. And this will then help us to then manage to settle a lot more matters or dispose of a lot more matters internally before they actually go out externally. We also have a mandate in terms of the Consumer Protection Act to provide advisory opinions or clarification opinions. In relation to our baseline, we've obviously dealt with 9 initiatives in the sense that we've been able to put guidelines in place in relation to making sure that we deal with advisory opinions and the methodology that we'll be able to utilize. But we expect that on an annual basis, we will be preparing reports that consolidate the advisory opinions that have been provided to different stakeholders in industry and make sure that we start to create a body of information or interpretations around the Consumer Protection Act as presented by the Consumer Commission. Another strategic objective under enforcement and compliance is to obviously protect consumers against unethical business practices through law enforcement and compliance. And compliance, which is obviously a continuation of the previous measure that we dealt with. The other methodology that we intend on putting in place is making sure that we have codes of practice in terms of Section 93, which is obviously the issues around making sure that, well, currently we obviously have to make sure that we deal with issues like plain and simple language, etc. But going forward, we want to put in place codes of practice in order to deal specifically with vulnerable consumers. And you'll see that in the 2012-13 financial year, we talk about coming up with a code for persons living with disabilities. Then the next year we'll deal with a code dealing with minors. The next year we'll deal with a code that deals with the needs of seniors. The year after that we will then deal with consumers that live in remote isolated and low density population areas. Then obviously in the final year we'll deal with those who are low income persons. And these are obviously all individuals that are referred to in terms of the Consumer Protection Act as vulnerable consumers. We also intend on dealing with the industry codes of conduct, which is something that we're already grappling with, but we expect that we'll be able to deal with at least accreditation of 3 different industries per financial year, and that will increase, obviously, with time. In fact, it will actually stay as 3 industries per financial year for the 5-year period. But obviously, this will be dependent on the number of applications that we receive or how many, the number of approaches that we receive from different industries or even the complaints that we receive in relation to conduct within different industries. That will influence what kind of industry codes we put in place in order to remedy those challenges in those industries. With regard to exemptions, which is also a statutory an obligation that rests within that rests on the Commission, that whenever there's an application for exemption by an industry, then the Minister then calls upon the Commission to give advice in relation to that. We expect that in all the requests for advice from the Minister of Trade and Industry in relation to applications for exemption, we will deal with 100% of all those matters that are referred to the Commission for our advice on the matters. We'll also, in relation to our research and policy units, we expect that we will come up with 3 consumer research study reports per year, and that will also center around issues of vulnerable consumers in the first financial year, but we'll obviously deal with other areas as and when the need arises. And obviously, if honourable members would like to know, I will give information around specifically what other areas we're looking at, but we are also looking at different industries, as you'll see under Measure 4.2. We'll be looking specifically in relation to some of the industries that we'll be looking at is the motor industry, because we've noticed that we've received a lot of complaints from the motor industry. We'll also be looking at issues around the timeshare industry, because we've also received quite a number of complaints in relation to timeshare, and we'll also be looking at other areas that relate to retail as and when the need arises in relation to that. But we expect that the number of industries will increase over the years, and we've put the industries at 11 industries in the 2015-2016 financial year, increasing to 13 industries in the 2016-2017 financial year. The issue of in relation to stakeholder relationship management, we expect that we will have we'll continue by the same method that we've been working to formalize memorandums of understanding and service level agreements. This really is in relation to industries where there is an overlap of jurisdiction between the Commission and those specific entities. We thought it may be prudent that we actually put in place memorandums of understanding so that we can agree on how we work together, especially in a matter where there is concurrence of jurisdiction. With regard to 5.2, we also, in relation to our stakeholder relationship management, we are still optimistic that we will be able to put in place standing advisory committees, and we believe these are very important in relation to our work and feeding into the Commission on an ongoing basis in relation to specific challenges that consumers face on the ground on an ongoing basis. So we do believe that the standing advisory committees need to continue, and we've put them in our strategic document, and you will note that every year they will be expected to come up with an annual recommendation or report in relation to the different standing advisory committees, and we believe that this report will be very beneficial for the workings of the Commission going forward, but it will also be presented to the Minister, who will then get a very overall view, a holistic view of consumer protection issues and challenges, not only from a Commission's point of view, but from a wider point of view, which is from the perspective of consumers themselves. Issues of organizational development. We obviously have an obligation in terms of the laws of the country, both the PFMA and in terms of the Public Service Act, to put in place, establish a functional organization. We have obviously put in place the critical policies and standard operating procedures, but we do believe that on an ongoing basis, as National Treasury gives us guidelines around financial matters, there will be a need to obviously put in place relevant policies, even in relation to the Public Service Act or the Public Service Commission, when they obviously give us different guidelines around how we should actually govern the institution or deal with issues in the institution. We'll put in place the different policies and the standard operating procedures as and when it's required. With regard to issues of human capital, we expect that the 60% within 2012-2013, 60% of the workforce of the Commission will be female, but we expect that it will increase to 70% within the 2014-2015 financial year, and then we'll obviously review it on an ongoing basis. And we expect that it will be 70% both at executive and senior level. So it wouldn't just be in the organization overall, but we expect to escalate it to both executive and senior level, and we expect it to reach the level of 70% within the 2014-2015 financial year. With regard to employment for persons with disability, we expect that it will increase from 4% to 7% by 2014-2015, and we will review it and maintain it, but obviously if there's a need to increase it, we will definitely increase it, but those are the projections that the Commission is actually putting forth. And with regard to the funded positions, because we have been asked before as to how many positions, we are generally asked by the Portfolio Committee as to the extent to which we've populated a structure in relation to funded positions. We expect that it will increase from 35% to 50% with reaching 100% within the 2015-2016 financial year. But I'm sure all the honourable members are aware of the fact that at the end of the day, this is obviously dictated by finances, because we obviously cannot fill positions if they're not funded, but we expect that we will at least be able to fill some of them and then increase at least 100% mark within the next 4 years. In relation to issues of employee wellness, we believe that this is critical, and we will be putting in place different programs to make sure that within the means that we have to make sure that our employees are fully functional within the work environment, and we are compliant with the legislation around ensuring that there is proper employee wellness and protection within the work environment. With regard to the performance management system, which is also a requirement in terms of the PFMA, you will see that we started it at a baseline of 0%, because to date, the performance agreement of the Commissioner has not been signed, so it obviously it does become very difficult. Had it been signed, we would have obviously escalated, would have obviously made sure that all the other employees within the organization have performance agreements, but to date it has not been signed, so that makes causes a challenge to the workings of the Commission and making sure that we comply with the requirements of the PSMA. We do hope and we're optimistic that in the next financial year the performance agreement would be signed, which will then help us to then diffuse it within the organization and ensure that all other employees within the NCC equally have performance agreements, because I'm sure you know that a performance agreement starts from the top and flows down into the organization. With regard to communication and marketing, the brand awareness, you will see that obviously the brand awareness for index needs to be put in place. We need to ensure that the consumer voice is heard loud and clear, and we expect that we will have survey samples of consumer satisfaction ranging from 30%. Well, we expect that from the surveys that we'll conduct around consumer satisfaction, that satisfaction will increase from 30% and reach 90% and more by 2016, 2017, because it's important that we continue to engage with our stakeholders on an ongoing basis. Media engagements, these are on an ongoing basis, but we expect that we'll hold at least one press conference per year, 12 media interviews, 12 media releases on an ongoing basis, and we expect that to stay constant throughout the five-year period. But obviously, when the need arises, we'll obviously increase that particular those particular goals or particular targets. With regard to service standards, we believe that by the same token that we ask business or industry to have certain standards that they give consumers, we as the Commission need to also meet certain service standards. That's why we felt that it was important for us to have a service charter, and we expect that we will on an ongoing basis be maintaining that particular charter that has been developed and implementing it and making sure that we meet the standards that we put in the charter at the rate of with the optimal level at being at 98%. With regard to internal communication, we believe that it's not proper that our employees actually hear about work of the Commission from the newspapers. There must be internal communication, not only in relation to the work of the Commission, but in relation to all other issues that occur in the Commission. So we believe it's important that we have internal newsletters, internal news flashes. So we expect to have those put in place to make sure that staff of the NCC know that the left hand of the NCC knows what the right hand is doing. With regard to ICT infrastructure and networks, we expect that we will at least have 80% of the infrastructure in place, 90% of applications, and 90% of services. You will note that we have been before this committee before talking about the fact that we don't have we need access to Microsoft Word, and that we are obviously not we don't have optimal access to it today. That's why we are hoping that at least in the next financial year we'll have resources to be able to properly procure the relevant applications and services so that we can be able to perform optimally. In relation to compliance with ICT systems and governance frameworks, there the critical issue to note is that in terms of the PSMA, we're expected to have a disaster recovery strategy and plan, and we would have that in place before the end of this financial year, and then it would really be a matter of just implementing and making sure that there's proper compliance in the event that there is any loss in relation to power or in relation to information. Financial management, we believe that we've got the risk management plan that has been developed. We believe that there's compliance with the shareholder compact. I also believe that the Commission is also has the relevant audit committee and internal audit. But obviously, the appointment of the audit committee is subject to the approval of the minister, and we're still awaiting the approval of the minister around the proposed members of the audit committee. But internal audit is in place, risk management is in place, and we expect that very soon we will get the approval that is required in order to make sure that we have a fully functional audit committee. I think really that then brings me to the end of the presentation in relation to the specific work of the Commission. I will then hand over to the CFO to then deal with the specifics around the budget of the NCC.
Thank you, Chair and honourable members. What I would like to present here is the budget for 2012 to 2015. All the allocations have already been made for 2012 to 2015, of which we cannot go over or go under. So for 2012-2013, we have been allocated 41.5 million, and it increased by 5.5% to 43 million, and then it went down to 42.5 million. This is not in control of the NCC, but what has been allocated and has been presented by the minister already to all the entities. So out of all the allocations that has been made, we have to play around with what has been given to us as to how we are going to expend all the revenue that has been allocated to us. So in 2012-2013, out of 41.5 million that we have been given, we have the staff cost and then goods and services and depreciation. For 2011-2012, we have already been given about 33 million rand, which has to be consumed by end of this financial year. So overall, the budget for last year to this year has increased from 33 million to 41.5 million. So this is not as significant as we would have wanted to, but I suppose all the entities don't have a choice because they're all given the certain amount of money or revenue for them to be able to consume. And then during the MTF period, that's when we'll be coming with all the budget motivations so that we might be able to have more than we want, because the 41 million that has been given won't be sufficient according to the original plan. So for 2013-2014, out of the 43.8 million that has been distributed, 24 million goes to staff costs, and then the goods services to 18.9, and then the depreciation of 590. And same applies to 2014, whereby the budget actually decreased from 43.8 million to 42.5. That is not likable, but I suppose due to constraints and Treasury, because I like to understand that it's in consultation with Treasury and the DTI, that's how we came to be given the 42.5 million. And for that, the 25 million for staff cost has been there, and then the goods and services 16.5, and depreciation 460,000. And that amounts us to the to a nil surplus or deficit. The next slide is basically just about the acquisition of assets, which is mainly the IT, whereby for 2012-2013 is 2.5, and 2013-14, 1.3. And I like to think that by 2014-15, we would be able to motivate to have something, because we can't be in a situation where we can get a zero. But the reality is that the budget is limited, and then we have to squeeze as much as possible out of the little that has been given. Thank you.
All right, thank you, CFO. Members, here's the presentation from the NCC. I think that what is critical about this presentation is that this is the new kid on the block of which we have nursed for some time. I think that is one of the institutions which has appeared many times compared to the other ones in front of this committee, because we have to ensure that this kid is able to run on and with love. When it graduates 1 year, it must be able to run, really, cannot be crawling. So it's up to us to be able to ensure that it achieves its goals and missions. Yeah? But at the same time, that's why we also have the group CEO of the Department of Trade and Industry. Because we also have another new kid on the block, which is the Company and Intellectual Property Commission. We want him to explain what support is he giving to this entity to ensure that they fulfill their mandate. You can see from the CFO of the National Consumer Commission, he's already crying that they've been squeezed to the limit. But I think what is critical here is that we must open up so that we'll be able to support them accordingly. Honourable members, this is your presentation, not my presentation. I want us to start the engagement with this. But what I'd like us to do
is to manage the time, né? Because as we said that this is a committee week, by afternoon at 2, the members must be able to attend the other committees in which they are scheduled for. So I expect Mr. Tlau and Mr. Mabasa and Mr. Supan and Maribel plus Mr. Kawaza to be free at least by 1:30. So that if the other committees have got engagements in the afternoon, they are free to do that. So let us limit the orientary part and just go straight to the crux of the matter. I think the crux of the matter here is the issue of the finances, because we are expending money as Parliament. Last week we agreed on the fiscal framework for this government. Né? So once we agreed on that, it means that we can no longer change the budget. What we are going to change is only when I'm going to take from somewhere else, take it to somewhere else again. So I think that we must really try to zoom in around those issues. So that Honourable Lau, Honourable Supan Amembe, Honourable Albert, and Dr. Wenman Chem.
You're right, sir. I was going to talk to the issue of finance. And my issue is the plan as a result are good, and they would need more funds, and the projected budget seems to be moving to reduction. It will go down. How do they plan to handle that contradiction?
Very good.
Is it me? Thank you very much. And thank you very much for the presentation, and I think that this committee's objective is to establish properly, or to ensure that you and your team establish this commission with the greatest amount of support and in the most solid way. And I think it's a very good presentation. I think it looks like all the systems are in place. On the question of the finances, the CFO mentioned that you need to finish spending your $33 million by the end of this month, because that's how Treasury works. So I just wanted to give an update on how that expenditure is panning out. And my second question is, in the two inner years, 12-13 and 13-14, with the capital expenditure amount, would that include the IT program that you need to properly effect your work? Thanks.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'm also still concerned about the budget allocation, and I think while the Commission doesn't have control over that, us as a committee must continue to put pressure on the Minister to try and get a proper budget for the NCC going forward, because they play a very big role in South Africa, especially with regards to safeguarding the interests of the poor people in South Africa who can't afford legal expertise. Then just a question. On the complaint and handling system, three consumer protection practitioners will be appointed in the provinces. Can you just elaborate what they actually will do in the provinces? And then on enforcement and compliance issue, measure 3.1, three industries will be chosen every year to be investigated for complaints and compliance. Can you just indicate how you select those industries? And just as a matter of interest, whether you are looking at investigating the tolling system in South Africa at all? And then, just lastly, on measure 3.6, enforcement and compliance, you refer to drafting of industry codes and dealing with exemption applications. Can you just indicate how those are selected, or how do they come to you? Thank you very much.
Dr. Wilmer.
Thank you very much, Chair. I also wanted to thank you for your presentation and say that you're clearly doing what needs to be done. I'm a little concerned that you're not aggressive enough in some cases, because what I think needs to happen is that the question of consumer protection has to be front and center in terms of the public's mind. And there are a number of ways in which one can do that, working together with newspapers. I mean, consumer protection as push through newspaper columns is a very important vehicle. And in particular, to name and shame product failures. We have serious systematic product failures. They should be named in terms of what they are. There's a certain political party that handed out defective condoms at a rally recently. The question is, how did that happen? I mean, how is it that there are defective condoms in the marketplace? How does the SABS test for standards? I mean, that's a particularly reckless example, SABS, Bureau of Standards. Thank you very much. If I may continue. The voice of those who represent consumers was largely silent when it came to the Walmart transaction. Walmart, in fact, is good for consumers because it drives down the retail price. And so I think there are innovative areas by which you could push the interests of consumers in a manner that would place the question front and center in the public's mind. So those are the 2 points I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thank you, members. With the rate we are going, really, it's going to be one of the fastest meetings we've ever come across. But there's something which also I wanted to raise. One of the issues the Constitution enjoins us that as the country, we must bridge the historical divide, the historical disadvantaged people, so that they are able to also play meaningfully in the mainstream. I like the fact that where you categorize the various customers, the clients, according to the living standards which they are involved with. So what effort are you really dealing with those people who are, as I said, at historical disadvantage to ensure that they are protected? They must not be knowing all their rights, whatever. So I think that that's the critical aspect. So the issue of deciding on the three industries which are going to investigate, what informs you to take such a decision? I think...
Thank you very much, honourable members. Maybe if I could take the questions in reverse, I'll do the last one first and then work it backwards. The questions that were asked by the honourable chairperson, yes, the issue around the historical divide is something we're very alive to, and we're also alive to the fact that it seems that the Commission is somewhat falling short of reaching consumers in rural areas. But what we have done is we are actually trying to collaborate with the provinces to make sure that the provincial offices of consumer protection that fall under the MECs of economic development also implement programs similar to ourselves, and we obviously then look at issues of reach in relation to our programs vis-a-vis those that are undertaken by the provinces. And this is really in relation to issues of awareness. We also use this methodology with regards to complaint handling, in that when they go out and do awareness in rural areas, we also ask them to deal with issues of consumer complaints when they undertake this work. So we, in that particular by that particular methodology, I think we are able to reach quite a number of consumers. But over and above that, I think one of the honourable members spoke to the issue around the accreditation of consumer protection practitioners within the provinces. We think this will also be a very key catalyst in relation to bridging the urban-rural divide, because these practitioners that you intend on appointing in the provinces will be responsible for creating awareness around the work of the Commission, awareness around the Consumer Protection Act. They will also be trained with regard to basic ADR skills, so that when they do come across consumer complaints that can be resolved easily, they actually do try and make an effort to actually resolve those particular matters and only escalate them to the Commission if they are unable to deal with them. So that, we believe, will be a critical tool, and I think it also answers the question that was asked by the honourable member as to what it is, are these practitioners in the province is going to actually do. And the method by which we'll obviously appoint these particular individuals is that we'll obviously call upon community leaders, such as your councillors and your traditional leaders in the areas, to actually make recommendations with regard to individuals that they believe would be suitable for the exercise. But we'll obviously put in place the minimum criteria as the Commission, so that when they go out and look for individuals, they measure them according to the criteria that the Commission has put in place, because they have to have certain minimum competencies in relation to the work that is required. With regards to the three industries that need to be investigated, what's complaints that we have and which industries they emanate from. For the next financial year, it will be from an informed point of view in relation to the level of complaints that we receive from the different industries. So the next financial year will be based on the number of, on the number of complaints from that particular industry, and we'll go into investigations around that. And if you recall, I did speak to the issue of the motor industry because it seems that the motor industry is topping the charts with regard to the complaints that we're receiving from consumers. For both second-hand and brand-new vehicles, we are receiving quite a substantial number of complaints in relation to that. So we expect that we'll do that kind of, we'll do investigations into that. The ICT sector still remains a problem, and we don't believe we actually completed all the investigations that we started last financial year, so we'll still be looking into it. We'll also be looking into the retail and manufacturing sector. Because in the last financial year, we just basically only did inspections in urban areas in relation to retail, and we believe we need to actually now look into the manufacturing sector as well. And we haven't had that opportunity in the last financial year, so we'll be carrying that over. So it will really be informed by the number of complaints that we had. The next set of questions was around the Commission not being aggressive enough. Honourable Member, I think we've now got the license to go out and really make sure that we deal with the kind of awareness that is required. In fact, we've been criticised as being too overly zealous, but I think if there's a perception out there that we're not zealous enough, we'll obviously accelerate and do a lot more. Make sure that we obviously do it in a strategic way, because I think that the intervention was around being strategic and taking advantage of issues that are topical and that are being debated, and make sure that our voice is heard. But we've always tried as the Commission to make sure that whenever there is topical issues that we believe have implications on consumers, we obviously get involved with regard to those debates. And we do accept that with regard to the Walmart matter, it is something that may have slipped through the cracks, but it did not slip through the cracks unconsciously. It slipped through the cracks from a conscious point of view, in the sense that we felt that by the time the Commission came into full swing, the discussions around the Walmart deal were already at an advanced stage. So it did pose a bit of a challenge with regard to us getting involved at that point. But we will obviously, in relation to future discussions, obviously make sure that we participate and we have a role with regard to that. The issue around the condoms and the role of SABS, I do believe that SABS does fall under the DTI family of entities, and it may be something that the committee would want to canvass with SABS when they do come through. But we have also received a complaint around condoms that are sold by a specific retailer, and the consumer in question says he had a product failure on four different occasions. And he has actually presented these to this particular retailer, and it's a major retailer who I won't mention now, but will obviously be going public with regard to this. And these condoms have now been referred to SABS for testing, because that is the entity that we have an MOU with in relation to obviously testing products. And we're expecting that we should be getting a report in the very near future in relation to and the quality of these specific condoms. We've also had other complaints around product failure, around roll-ons, you know, the deodorant roll-on that actually causes consumers to develop boils under their armpits. And this this leads to a lot of financial prejudice to the consumer, because then they have to go to and undertake operations, and there's a lot of pain and suffering that goes into that. And these are major brands who have received these complaints, and we're obviously investigating in order to come up with the report and a way forward. But we also have recourse in relation to the provisions of the Consumer Protection Act, where we can actually ask for those products to be recalled, meaning that all of them would have to then be removed from the shelves, so that consumers are not continuously exposed to the hazards that come from these particular products. But we note the issue around being more aggressive, and we obviously will take up that point and ensure that we create more awareness. But I think one thing that must also be understood is that we had a very aggressive program with regard to consumer awareness, but we've had to obviously pull back a bit, because it obviously does involve a lot of it does involve spending quite a lot of money in relation to creating awareness around the Consumer Protection Act. So we've had to pull back in relation to the fact that we did not have the relevant resources around it. The issue around exemptions and codes under 3.6 and 3.6A, in relation to the issue, okay, first let me speak to the exemptions. How are these selected? Really, with this, the role of the Commission is very reactive, because an industry will make an application through its regulator that may be exempted from the provisions of of the Consumer Protection Act, and this application is made to the Minister of Trade and Industry, who then, in terms of the Act, has an obligation to then approach the Commission and ask for our advice in relation to that particular application. And what we consider is whether or not that industry or that sector actually has a piece of legislation that would give the consumer equal or superior protection than what the Consumer Protection Act provides for that consumer. If it does not have such a piece of legislation, then we will make a recommendation against the minister granting exemption. If it does, then we'll obviously make a recommendation in favor of that exemption being granted. With regard to the codes, as you note, we obviously, in this particular context, we are influenced by two specific factors. An industry can approach the commission of its own accord and request that they would like a code of practice to be put in place for that particular industry. If we believe that there is a need for that code of conduct to be put in place, then we'll obviously engage in negotiations with that industry, and if we feel that it needs to be approved, then we'll put it in place. An industry can actually come for approval for a code alone or a code with an ombuds scheme linked to actually ensuring that there's enforcement of that particular code. The other way is if we believe that a particular industry has certain conduct that we believe is of a nature that it can cause serious prejudice to consumers, then the Commission of its own accord can then propose a code for that particular industry, and then that code will then govern the rules of engagement in relation to that particular industry. So those are the two ways in which the different codes will be put in place. And what we're referring to in relation to the strategic document are the codes that have already been presented to the Commission for the Commission's consideration. We've received requests from the retail industry. We've received proposals for codes from the airline industry, from the advertising industry, from the motor industry. So those are the ones that we expect that we'll be able to then process and address accordingly. With regard to the issue of the tolling system and the investigation, I think the Honourable Member may have missed some of the articles in the media around that. The Commission has undertaken an investigation, not into the tolling system, but in relation to the terms and conditions of contract that would be attached to the e-tolling. And we are in discussions with Sandro right now to make sure that the terms and conditions of contract are amended to comply with the Consumer Protection Act. So we've had a workshop with them, and they've indicated that they will take our analysis to the board for consideration, and we expect that they will revert to the Commission by the 4th of April. And then that will obviously inform the way forward in relation to whether there will be a need then to issue a compliance notice to make sure they comply with the CPA, or they will of their own accord amend the terms and conditions to make sure that they're CPA compliant. So our jurisdiction is only in relation to the terms and conditions of contract and compliance with the CPA. We do not have jurisdiction beyond that. But we are in discussions, and we believe this is a matter that will be finalized in the very near future. And we have also received a complaint from the Democratic Alliance in relation to certain aspects of the e-tolling system, and it is a complaint that we have forwarded to Sandro. Sandro has responded to that complaint. We are now waiting for comments from the Democratic Alliance around the comments that we've received from Sandro. So once we have that, then that will inform the way forward with regard to that. In relation to the issue of, I think, the provinces, I think 2.2, I already answered that when I answered the question from the chairperson. I think the other questions I will hand over to the CFO. Safe to say that with regard to the question around the 2013 and 2014 capital expenditure, whether it includes our IT costs, no, it does not include the IT costs. Specifically, well, the IT costs in relation to ensuring that the entity is fully operational. And specifically here, I'm talking about the case management system, and I'm also referring to the issues of the call center. The reason it does not include that is that it was made emphatically clear that we need to work within the allocation that National Trade has given us. So we are not allowed to budget for a surplus or for a deficit. So at the end of the day, we then obviously had to cut out all other programs that we did not have a budget for. So in effect, we don't expect that in the next 3 years we'll be able to have a case management system or a fully fledged call center based on what has been allocated. I'll ask the CFO to then deal with all these other questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. The first question that I noted is about how do we plan to work within the limited budget that we have. I think in preparation of this budget, already some of the projects have been cut, especially research and I think consumer awareness. I think it's marketing and communications. So the one that I understand is based on the project that we have, most of the projects will be done in-house instead of going wild to the media and informing the public on how the commission works and so forth. So we try basically to work within what we have that the NCC employees can do to inform the public, obviously without the financial muscle. So that's the only way that the commission at the moment operates. And hopefully with the MTF motivation, we like to believe that the Treasury and the DTI can be able to assist in giving us more money after the motivation of what we need to plan. So that's a plan for now. And then the second question was relating to the 33 million rand that we have been allocated as to how far we are with that. That I can say that is almost consumed. If you remember the last meeting that we had, we basically had to get some funding from the DTI to be able to finance some of the costs that we projected that we will be spending by the end of financial year. So that is almost consumed, meaning that we're not going to over budget. We're still going to work within what we projected and estimated that we will be spending. So by end of March, all the fixed costs that we anticipate to pay will basically amount to the budget to be fully spent. I'm not sure if I missed any questions.
All right, I think you answered all the questions, but I think that they're raising the red flags. Your responses are actually raising the red flags, which is very disturbing. I can make an example here. When you say that they have cut consumer awareness, the very essence of the commission, and then you also spoke about cutting the issue of the research again. And then what was also worrying was what the commission has said, that the issue of the IT, if they are not going to have that thing. But I thought that before, I was not in the last meeting when they presented, but I think that we spoke with the department. There was this Swiss fund which was supposed to help them set up all the infrastructure which is required to do that. So the question which will arise is from the department is how far are we complying with that, and then what's the problem? Dr. James, a chance to ask one question, a follow-up. All right. Just one follow-up before.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to ask a follow-up question on the condom story. I mean, you would agree that condom failure has consequences that fall entirely in a cloth of its own, because it has, mortal consequences, not the same as a roll-on. And therefore, if there's any suspicion that people are at risk, South Africa's at risk because of the fact of condoms, is a question of great urgency in terms of getting a report. Two, that if there are any products out there that are potentially faulty, they should be pulled off the shelves immediately. And therefore they require some emergency steps. So, I mean, my questions are, is that the report to which you referred, when will that report arrive? If the report states that there are, in fact, defective condoms out there and that South Africans are at risk, then how will you go about putting those off the shelves as a matter of an emergency? On what basis do you justify not naming the retailer? I mean, what are the grounds for not naming that retailer, given the fact that condoms fall in the cloth of their own because of the consequences? It's not like a roll-on. It really isn't. So what is the basis for not naming the retailer? I understand that obviously you don't want to be reckless about this and sound alarms, but there has to be a decision-making process that is quite robust.
Thank you, Prof. Honorable Albert, is it a follow-up? Or, of course, we are going to have another round of questions next. So can you ask the department to respond and the commission?
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to the honourable members.
Just to reiterate that you know, the budgeting is a process whereby we engage extensively with National Treasury to get funding. And you are no doubt aware that last year, right across the board, we had to take what is called a haircut. And I think the NCC was one of the few institutions that got an increase in their budget. However, what we have done is we've invited the NCC to arrange a workshop where we will sit in and engage very soon to engage on their budgetary requirements and ensure that it's properly motivated and start the process of engaging with National Treasury immediately rather than wait August, September this year. And hopefully, maybe during the adjustment estimate, they could be supplemented with additional funding if the motivation is good. With respect to the sweep funding, we have allocated an additional 1.8 million rand in the current financial year, which money that has been transferred already to the NCC. But what we also said to them, there's a further just over 7 million rand available. We indicated to them they can utilize that for the case management, for IT infrastructure. However, they must commence with the procurement process immediately. And we need to satisfy ourselves that that procurement process was fair and transparent before we transfer those funds. So that directive has already been given to the NCC, so they do have money for case management and some IT infrastructure. Thank you.
Commissioner, on the issue of that field, I think that one is the agent, it's a national risk.
Thank you very much, Chair. No, we do realize that this is a complaint that we actually received, I believe, last week. So we are actually giving it our urgent attention. The only issue and concern here is that we obviously need to get the report from SABS. And I have indicated to my team that, because from the report we have, is that the matter was referred by the retailer on receiving a copy of the complaint, because what we do is when we see the complaint, we forward it to the retailer. And then they proactively went to SABS to ask for this report. But I've indicated to the team that we cannot wait till the end of the month, because the proposed date was the end of the month. And I've requested that that they request that SABS give us a report by the 23rd of this month, which should be Friday. But I'm not sure what the position is now, because obviously that is an instruction that I gave yesterday prior to leaving the office, because I do understand the urgency and the importance of making sure that we resolve this. It's not only an issue from an HIV point of view, but it's also an issue of unwanted pregnancies, which can obviously result in damages claims being brought against the specific manufacturers. The issue around, so we are hoping for the 23rd, but I'll have a proper report from the office when I get to the office. What I could propose is that I can then send a letter to the chairperson of the committee just to indicate whether or not we will be receiving it on Friday. And if we cannot get it on Friday, then we'll have to look at other alternatives. But the issue is here, I think it must be understood that any testing by a laboratory does cost money. Now, it is something that obviously we would not have a budget for, because it is not something that was anticipated. So we would have to then go and talk to DTI about it, and there is a process that is followed, and it may not have the turnaround time that we would expect. So that could be a challenge. So we're going to have to try and apply pressure on SABS in relation to the test that's already being conducted, because I believe we'll get a faster result with regard to that. The issue around why we cannot name the retailer is because we are currently faced with a very difficult situation whereby we have actually received a letter whereby the motor industry specifically has written to the chairperson of this committee indicating that we go public on matters before they be finalized by the tribunal. So now we're caught between a rock and a hard place as to do we talk, do we not talk. So it then becomes quite problematic that in this particular instance we have no problem with naming the entity. In fact, I have done so in the past. But now I'm sitting with a letter whereby the chairperson of the committee via the Director General of Trade and Industry has now written me a letter to say that the motor industry is complaining that we reveal cases, we talk about cases publicly even before they have been resolved. So I would need to really get guidance around what is the correct methodology that would be suitable. Because I can name the entity, then tomorrow I'll have another letter whereby I'm being asked why is I spoke publicly about a matter. So it then makes it very difficult for us to obviously deal with these issues. And obviously I can make those letters available if the committee wants to see them, but yes, I am sitting with a letter of that nature. So it does become very difficult for us to then know, do we speak, do we keep quiet? But the issue around the recall, once we have scientific proof that confirms, we'll then immediately go public and ask for the recall. So, but on the issue of the naming of the entity, should you want the name, I'm more than willing to give it, but I'd obviously then need clarity then as to when do we name, when do we not name, and what is the view of the committee. But obviously I'm faced with this particular matter and it does become problematic from where I sit. Or difficult, let me not say problematic, difficult to know when we can name and when we cannot name. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I think that the advice of the chairperson is correct. Yeah. Because what happens is that in the process, we don't want to destroy what we're having. What is critical here is that sometimes when they say you go and name something, and then when after the investigation, it's found that it is not like that, and then you have already jeopardized that company. But I think that immediately, when the lab results have come out and then have confirmed that, then there's no way we're going to hide that. We're not hiding, actually. We're protecting the image of the company, just like yourself. If you're accused of something, I cannot say that you have stolen something unless I can prove in the court of law that that thing has happened. I think that we must have that balance. It's not a matter of hiding. It's a matter of being cautious. Because at the end of the day, you know, we're going to have company commission. You know, for our economy to thrive, actually, our companies must be very strong. You cannot destroy the matter. Honorable members, I'm going to have the last round. I'm going to start with those people who were not there in the first round. I saw the hand of Honorable Kwabaza. Welcome home, Mekosi. Welcome home. And then Honorable Albert, from any other one, or Honorable Slau, and then the last one, and then we close this matter.
Just quickly, Chairperson, I wanted to ask a question in relation to the budget on page 9. Of the sticker document and find out whether that 6.7 million is factored into the 22.5 million on this two pages. Because if that is not so, then it presents a bit of a problem. That then leads me to write on Comrade Hugh's question on what informed the decline in 2014. Of the budget, because certainly the employee compensation alone would be affected in terms of it rising, as I see it rising, by the annual wage increases. One explanation could be that if that 6.7 is factored, then the decline is notwithstanding the annual wage increases, would be balanced up by the decline in the purchase of goods and services. Is that the correct understanding?
Honorable Albert.
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to know with regards to the cell phone companies, whether you've made any headway. I know that some of them are protesting and saying that you don't have jurisdiction. I'd just like to know where you stand with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honorable Jim.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say that when it comes to the condom question, that the ethical protocols clearly have to be in place to deal with it, and that there cannot be a budgetary reason for not doing the testing. I mean, first of all. So whoever needs to pay for it, they must just pay for it. Secondly, the issue you quite clearly write when you say that what you have to protect against is frivolity in terms of people being frivolous in terms of complaints. And you cannot name a retailer on the basis of a frivolous complaint. I mean, that will destroy their business. So it's right for the reporters to come in. And since it is an emergency, it's important for it to come in early, and it'd be certain to come in early. And if it is the case that the condoms are defective and they need to pull it, then that's the time to, in fact, decide as to whether one should name the retailer or not.
Okay. To get clarity here as to research versus investigation, whether research in the context of the work of the Consumer Commission is synonymous to to investigate? And if it is, how can the consumer protection continue without that?
I think Honourable Slough, as the Commissioner, can answer this question.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. I think if I may just use the same methodology of answering the questions in reverse. The issue around this research and investigation, there is obviously a slight distinction in the sense that research really is to gather the information, but it does feed into investigations because you need research to feed into investigations so that there's credibility in relation to the investigations that we undertake and obviously the reports that we produce after investigations. Because we also have rights to have recourse to international best practice and what is happening in other jurisdictions, and research is the one that actually collects this data and feeds into investigations. Now, with regard to your second question as to how can we survive without that, I actually don't know. However, to date, really, you've had to have people wearing many different hats. You've had to have people in legal, sometimes doing research, sometimes doing legal work, sometimes doing investigations. So you'll note that a lot of the people that I've appointed as investigators in terms of the Act are not just only investigators. There are people who are sometimes complaint handlers, who when there's an investigation, then I move them to do that particular investigation. Then when there is, then there are some from legal who have moved in from legal to do an investigation when there's a big investigation. For instance, the Auction Alliance one. We have people from research who have been appointed as investigators, people from complaint handling, people from legal. So that's basically what we've had to do. People have had to juggle many different roles in order for us to actually make sure we do the work and we deliver in terms of our mandate. But I think I've already said this before this committee. I don't know how sustainable that is because at the end it does cause strain because people will end up suffering from fatigue as a consequence of doing many different things at the same time. But at the same time, I'm sure you know we are getting a pressure from consumers and from Parliament to make sure that we actually deliver. I mean, we get letters from parliamentarians who are approached by members of the public who say they've lost a complaint to the Commission. What is the status of the complaint? So we also have to deal with that. So basically, that is how we're basically operating currently. And it is strenuous, but we are obviously challenged in that sense, and we need to obviously deal with it, deal with things the best way we can. With regard to the issue around the condom story, we are obviously going to try a little bit, but the issue of the budget needs to be made available, I think the reality is very different in the sense that if there is no money in our bank account currently, I cannot commit to it. Because if, as the accounting officer, I go and authorize expenditure, I will have the AG here with me before this committee in September to say we have not managed the finances of the institution properly. So if there is no money in our account currently that is set aside for this specific purpose, I cannot commit to this committee that we will do so. Because if I do, I will then have made a commitment to Parliament that I cannot meet. And if I try to meet it, at the end of the day, I will then be in trouble with the AG. So the reality is, because the money is not currently in the account, and we will have to wait until the next budgetary allocation, which is for the next financial year, which is, I assume, we'll get money from the 1st of April, then, only then, can we then start to talk about the possibility. But even then, you do understand that it is the budget is also already a very strained budget. So I that is the reality that we are faced with, and I unfortunately cannot make that commitment. Much as I would like to, because I think this is critical, this is important, but we are now going to have to wait for the report that is being procured by the retailer from SABS for us to then be able to make an informed decision going forward. So we would really be dependent on that particular report. But obviously the stick we do have is that if the report doesn't come in, then we have the right to issue a compliance notice, then they'll have to explain it at the tribunal. But the downside of that is that a date for the tribunal we have no control around the dates and how they're allocated. So we'd have to wait until the matter is set down before the tribunal, which could mean that these condoms would still be in the market until a decision is made by the tribunal on the matter. So that is the reality of the situation we sit in. The other issue is around the cell phone company. These are other matters that are before the tribunal. I'm sure you'll note that only one matter has been argued to date. That is the MTN matter. Vodacom, Cell C are still to be set down for argument. They have not yet been set down for argument. And unfortunately, once the matter is before the tribunal, we are at the mercy of the tribunal. They have to make a decision around the matter. So we are still waiting for outcomes around this particular matter. But yes, the issue still continues until the decision, or until the tribunal actually makes a decision to have it set aside. What we had done is that we had actually obtained a legal opinion which stated that according to the interpretation of the Consumer Protection Act, a compliance notice comes into force and effect as soon as it is signed, and it is signed by the commissioner and served on that particular entity, which would mean they have to comply until there is a contrary decision by the tribunal. But now the problem is we would need to get an order of court, a declaration by a court to confirm that that is the correct interpretation. Because once you could get that particular interpretation, that would really help, because then it would mean that once a compliance notice is issued, whatever conduct is being undertaken contrary to the Consumer Protection Act must persist until the tribunal finds to the contrary. But because we obviously don't have the funds to actually take this matter to court for the declarator, it then makes it difficult for us to enforce it. So now the way things are happening is that we issue a compliance notice, and its full force and effect only comes into effect once the tribunal has made a decision, which means that we wait, because we all know that the challenge that the tribunal has is that the members of the tribunal are part-time. So then obviously their schedules need to be coordinated to make sure that they're available for the hearing of the matter. So that obviously does then delay the processes. So that really is the issue. So we are hoping that at some point we will have decisions around the different matters that have been heard by the tribunal, and we'll have some finality with regard to these matters. The issues around the budget and the decline in 2014, I'll just ask the CFO to deal with it. But from my understanding, the decline in the amount is based on the allocation that has been given by National Treasury. It's as a consequence of that there's a decline in the amount. But I'll leave it to you to add to that.
Thank you. If I understand you correctly, sir, you were talking about the 6.7 in the strategic document relating to positions that has to be filled. And then on this budget of 41.5 million that has been presented here under the compensation of employees, it didn't include that, because if we have to include that, basically the cost to the employees will literally be over 70% of the total budget that has been allocated. So that has to be reduced to be able to accommodate other costs of goods and services, which are stated at 18.5 million.
One committee for us, just you alone.
Yes. If that is so, then it suggests that you are not going to be able to fill all those posts during the 2012-2013.
If you recall, Honourable Member, we did indicate in the presentation that we'd only really be able to fill 35% of the approved structure. So we will not reach 100%, I think, I'm sorry to say, we'll only reach 100% in, which year is it? I think we reach it in the third financial year. Yes, but I think we only reach 100% in the 2015-2016 financial year, so we don't expect to be able to do so. And we're being optimistic that at that point the budget would have improved.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. I think members can see that the Commission is trying its best to execute its mandate with the limited resources that it's having. But I think also what is critical is the cooperation between the Commission and the Department. I don't think that without that cooperation, this institution cannot stand on its own. So what I'll appeal for is that there are certain issues which are urgent, of which if they are urgent, even if they are not in the budget, you must be able to communicate that with the Department.
so that they can go and tap from that SWIFT fund which they spoke about. I think that they spoke about 7 million, which is still there. But what is critical in the process is that you put a good case for that. I think that's what the group CFO has said, that put a good case for that and proper procurement so that it can be done. Because really, we cannot put the people's lives at risk because of a certain budgetary constraint. I think that the people's lives come first. You know, people first, that's why we speak about Batu first before any other thing. Yeah. So I think that what is critical is the cooperation between the department and the commission itself. I think that if you can have that relationship stronger, and then you can achieve more. Yeah. But I think that we are going to raise that with the minister. We'll raise it definitely with the minister and also with the director general. Also, the other issue is the issue of performance management. I think that it is a disaster if it is not in place. Because how are we going to judge whether a person is performing or not? How are we going to reward someone who's doing good? Because, you know, when people are juggling around like that, other people can hide in the process. What are you going to do with those people who are pulling, who are working very hard around those issues? I think also, members, that one is also the issue which will raise the minister, the issue of the performance with the national commissioner, because we cannot have an institution which will be viable if we don't have those systems in place. I think also the issue of risk, because from what I got from the group CFO, the issue of the processes of procurement, I think that also they must be tightened up, né, so that there can be no complaint from either side, né, so that PFMA was there, is there, né, so that it can be transparent as possible. But apart from being transparent, it's being responsible with the public funds. Because you must remember that whatever we spend in one program is an opportunity cost for the other program. It means that once we commit something to the NCC, it means that at the same time, we will not be able to commit the same thing in education or in health or in defense. So that's why the issue of the transparent procurement system, which is reliable, is very critical. While also appreciating the risk land of management, which we have dealt with in a strategic plan. Because once we put those things in place, is then that the integrity of the system then is going to be fair and transparent for everyone. So I think that we really appreciate what they're trying to do. We'll do our level best, Commissioner, to support the department, plus the commission, because our work here is to ensure that the government is delivering on its mandate. And the critical mandate it has to deliver in is the one, the human rights, two, the issue of the vibrant economy, three, the issue of employment creation, whatever. So if we are going to help the consumers who are alert, already on the product regard, we're already opening another sector on its own. That is the type of quality product which will come to the market are the ones which are going to enable us actually to sell better products as well. Yeah. So I think that each and every one has got a contribution to make. So we really appreciate your input. I think we'll meet you after with the members of the ministry after this meeting. We'd like to have a minute or two with you. Yeah, after this meeting, so that we can take a certain issue. Honourable members, I think that we're good on the time. Né? Up to so far, I think we're moving towards 11 o'clock. What I'd appeal for is that the company commission must set up its presentation. In the process, can you all quickly go for 5 minutes, get our tea, and come back? Because I'm going to give it only 1 hour, between 11 and 12. And then between 12 and 1, it is going to be the national regulator, so that at least we are covering everyone. So, thank you, members.
Morning, we'd like to take a little bit of time taking you through our strategy because it is a new strategy. We'd also like to present you with some benchmarking information. We are aware that we have limited time, so it's not exhaustive, but maybe it can just serve as a point of departure. And then we'd also like to present our budget and our operational focus for the next financial year. As you are all very aware, we as an institution became operational on the 1st of May last year, and although we are a new public entity, Schedule 3A,
We are also a going concern, and we took over the assets as well as the liabilities of existing institutions, that is Cipro and OCAI. And our challenge in the past year has been how do we forge a new institution with a new mandate from this merged entity, and how do we define a new mandate, a broadened mandate for ourselves on the one hand, and on the other hand, improve performance of the existing institutions. So this is what we have referred to in the past as building an aeroplane in mid-flight. So what we've done as part of this strategic plan, we actually have a very nice video that we could show you about what it feels like, but I think maybe in the interest of time, not today. So what we've done as an institution is we've really gone back to basics to try and understand and unpack our role and our mandate. And in doing that, we looked at a range of things. We looked at our strategic environment. We looked at our legislative mandate, but also specifically at the policy context and the need for alignment of the institution. We also examined in a fair amount of detail both the needs and the expectations of customers. And then, of course, the global environment. Now, you are, I think, very familiar with our legislative mandate, and the only point that we would like to make is that it is a vast mandate. We don't enforce one piece of legislation as the Consumer Commission and the NCR that we will be presenting to you today. We are responsible for 15 different pieces of legislation. So we have a very big mandate that spans from registration to compliance and education and policy. And although it may appear as a very diverse mandate, we also believe that it gives us a unique opportunity to explore the synergies that actually exist in these areas, between these different broad areas of law. That is the corporate regulation component and then the intellectual property. While we are accountable to the Department of Trade and Industry, and we're very much accountable, we also operate in a broader policy context. So we see the DTI as our mother department, but we also, part of our activities overlap with the department's mandates of the Department of Science and Technology, the Departments of Arts and Culture, Agriculture, and of course Economic Development. And so we looked at all those policies from these different departments to give us guidance in developing and understanding our mandate as an institution. And these are some of the key policy themes that we've extracted from that are applicable to us. The first is, of course, the imperative of economic growth and job creation. The second is the development and exploitation of South African innovation. I think the phrase in the 10-year innovation plan is converting ideas into economic growth. And I think we think that that's one of the big challenges, not just for the economy, but one that we need to play a role in. Then a number of policy documents talk about the stimulation of growth in key sectors, such as green technologies, agriculture, pharmaceuticals, business processes, and also refer to the creation of a knowledge economy. A number of documents talk about the potential of indigenous knowledge and its exploitation, and I think the committee is very aware of those debates. But I think one of the big issues there is also how do communities benefit from it. Then the Department of Arts and Culture and the New Growth Path both talk about the job creation potential for cultural and creative sectors, which is directly within our mandate because we regulate film, copyright, we regulate the music industry or the distribution of royalties in the music industry. And then I think another area that was of relevance to us is the importance of public and preferential procurement and the impact and this can have in both enterprise development but also in industry development. I think DTI's industrial policy talks about using procurement for industrial development. And we think as a CIPC and our registers should actually play a bigger role in that, in providing information for this. There's of course also the issue about developing South Africa's competitiveness. So it's about the ease of doing business. It's about encouraging and stimulating entrepreneurship and enterprise, having sustainable corporate entities. And then of course the whole issues around governance, which are critical. And last but not least, Matopele, the chair mentioned it earlier today, the importance of having a reliable, empathetic, respectful and efficient service delivery to all people in South Africa. So we looked at the policy context, the legislative mandate, and then we also looked more broadly at the strategic context. And these are, in this diagram, you see all the different issues that impact. So it would range from customer expectations, the impact of technology and social media in reaching out to customers, and the importance of knowledge and innovation for economies nationally but also internationally, the ease of doing business. So there are a whole host, and I would only like to pick up on a few of these in our presentation, but this is outlined in our strategic document. So the first is the economic context. We operate within a global recession. There's economic uncertainty, and even though it looks like the growth is likely to improve, we think that we still probably experience slow growth in South Africa, and both corporate and intellectual property registration tends to track economic growth. So we think that it'll be fairly level over the next 5 years. Economic crime, there's a big impact emphasis on this internationally. I've talked before to the committee about corporate identity theft, and you may recall that on the United UK Companies House website, they state that they receive 50 to 100 complaints of corporate identity theft every month. So it is an issue, international issue, and we are no exception, and people are finding, in the same way as they identify, as people try and commit banking fraud, defraud individual customers, people are also looking at corporate identity as a way of committing fraud. New wave all the time. There's an international emphasis on corporate governance and disclosure. So our South African legislation is not different in this. It's followed the trend, and this is a big issue for corporate registers around the world. And then the ease of doing business, something that you may be aware of. There is a survey that's done by the World Bank. It's done annually. And I think what's very important about this survey is that it's really seen as a way in which countries brand themselves and their business environment to attract investment into their economy, both into their businesses but also generally in terms of capital flow. And South Africa currently is ranked 35th. And that's something that we think we obviously need to maintain. The other regulatory trend that we observed is the changing role of intellectual property rights and their regulation, the place that regulation has and protection has, traditional forms of protection, which is what we provide by registration. Increasingly, intellectual property is seen as a valuable strategic asset for corporates, but also at a national level. And there is a huge trend internationally in IP licensing. But at the same time, so there's been a big emphasis on, historically, on protecting intellectual property by registering those rights. But what's happened is the emergence of low-cost manufacturing countries in the BRIC countries, largely. But that's fundamentally changed the IP landscape because of their ability, the ability of those low-cost manufacturers to copy products. So it changed the way that multinationals have looked at intellectual property rights and protection. It also means that, you know, economies themselves need to look at how they use that. So in India, for example, I think I mentioned this before, they see the role, they have big multinationals that they try and protect them the same way as the US does. But it means as well, you know, with technology changing and social media, there are lots of different ways in which one can enforce intellectual property rights. So So it is a changing environment. The other big issue that we thought were relevant is, of course, the small business landscape. And we tried to find some statistics on this to get an indication of where we fit it in and what the level of formalization of businesses are. And there isn't consistent data. They're different data sets, and they show different things. The one survey that we refer to is the FinSCO Small Business Survey. It's a 2010 survey. And in terms of that survey, it's estimated that there are 5.9 million small enterprises in South Africa of all sizes, so micro, including micro and survivalist businesses. But of those 5.9 million businesses, only 8.3 were registered with CIPRA. So it showed to us that there's a huge potential for registration, formalization of businesses. And what the survey also showed is that businesses in Gauteng, Northwest, and the Northern Cape were the most likely to be registered, and KwaZulu-Natal was the least likely to be registered. Even though 13.8% of small business owners reside in KwaZulu-Natal. So the statistics say, if you look at the distribution of small businesses, it's also slightly counterintuitive, because roughly 23% of small businesses are in Gauteng, which one would expect, 15% in the Eastern Cape, close to 14% in KwaZulu-Natal, and the Northwest makes quite a good showing at 13%. So there's clearly a lot of small business activity happening there, but what's also good is they tend to be quite compliant or formal. It's not, formalization and compliance obviously are two different things. Not all businesses need to be registered, because there are lots of compliance obligations. But there is a lot of potential for an increase in the registration of businesses. And I think probably fairly established businesses. The survey also outlines why businesses are not registered. And I think the first point that was relevant to us is that a lot of businesses who are registered, who claim to be registered, claim that there aren't a lot of benefits from registration. It's primarily that it imposes a compliance burden, but they don't necessarily see a lot of benefit from it. Those businesses that weren't registered, many of them felt that either their businesses were too small or that it was too complicated, but there was also an education component, as in people didn't know how to register. So what we took from that as an institution is that clearly we need to ensure that there is a better value proposition for registration, meaning that there needs to be more value to businesses in being registered, and we need to think about that, but also that there's a big opportunity to formalize. We looked at our customers, and we did a lot more detailed segmentation. We just outlined here at a high level what types of customers we have, and we see ourselves as having primarily four types of customers. Customers with registration needs, both whether that's corporate registration needs or people who want to register even as a business registry practitioner. Then we have customers with compliance needs. So certain registrations impose compliance obligations, and there are a certain set of needs around that. We have customers with redress needs. Generally, those would either be invested in registered entities, and it's all around registered entities or registered economic rights. And then lastly, we have customers with data and information needs. I'm not going to go into the detail. I'm sure you can have a look at that. So we took all this information that we gathered and explored and internally reviewed what our mandate and our strategy as an institution should be. And what we're presenting is effectively an emerging strategy. It's a new strategy, but we think that it will continue evolving over the next five-year period. Our vision as an institution is to be the leading gateway to growth and sustained participation in the formal economy, and we stress the formal economy for all, and we would also like to stress the all in South Africa. And at an aspirational level, at a visionary level, what we would like to do is we would like through insightful advice and responsive and reliable service to enable easy and informed access to our customers. And we hope that the integrity of our data, we are sure that in future the integrity of our data will inspire trust and confidence in all that we serve. We also wish to be worthy custodians of our mandate by supervising, maintaining, and enforcing the provisions of all the laws we administer with impartiality, integrity, and wisdom. So that is our vision for the institution. And that's what we would like at the end of 5 years, maybe a little bit longer, to be able to say with confidence we've achieved. Our mission is to unlock value in businesses and in intellectual property, and we need to do this by providing easy, accessible, and value-adding registration services to business entities and intellectual property rights holders, as well as practitioners that will be regulated. We need to maintain, by maintaining and disclosing secure and credible relevant information about these entities, also about corporate conduct and reputation, as well as intellectual property and indigenous cultural expression. We also would like to do this by increasing awareness and knowledge of company and intellectual property laws, but not just about the laws, also about the compliance obligations, as well as the opportunities that exist for business entities and for intellectual property rights holders to leverage growth and sustainability through the registration. That's what the value proposition must be. And then lastly, we would like to do this by taking the necessary steps to vividly, effectively, and efficiently monitor and enforce compliance with all the laws that we administer. So that's our vision. Our values, again, are different, and we spend quite a lot of time in the organization engaging with staff so that we can get representative values and a lot of buy-in to the values. And these are the five that we've identified as an institution. The first is a passion for service. And this is one thing that our staff actually feel very strongly about. And we would like, as one institution, to serve our customers passionately and seamlessly. We also believe integrity is very important, and we need to demonstrate integrity in all our actions, both as individuals but also as an institution, as an organization as a whole. We believe in empowerment of our employees but also of our partners. Accountability, which is a very important issue for our institution, and we need to be accountable in everything we do. And lastly, we believe in collaboration, both internally but also externally. And we think we need to, through our partners, various sets of partners, we will need partners to execute our mandate. We can't do it on our own. I'm not going to talk about the aspirational value proposition. We identified really four: the opportunity for growth, good governance, and conduct credibility we think is key. That should be, if you're registered, conduct credibility should go with that. The security of information that's been lodged with us, and then the ease of registration. Those are the things, that's the value proposition we think we need to offer businesses and intellectual property rights holders. So we've identified three strategic goals for the institution that bring all of these together. The first is that we think our goal should be to improve the competitiveness of the South African economy, and we would do that by enhancing the reputation of South African businesses and the South African business environment. Secondly, to contribute to a knowledge-based economy and competitive local industries by promoting innovation, creativity, and indigenous cultural expression and knowledge. And lastly, to promote broader formal economic participation by enhancing service delivery and extending the reach of CIPC. So it's three goals, and we've developed three programs that are aligned with the budget and our budget. The first goal, under the first goal, we have two objectives. The first objective is to encourage the formalization of South African businesses and their identity. And what we've grouped in this area, this is how we explore the synergies that we have with this diverse mandate, is we have historically, trademarks have always been viewed as purely intellectual property, but we think that trademarks really are about the brand and the reputation of a business, and that it should be more closely linked with corporate regulation. So in terms of our structure, we've grouped it with corporate regulation in terms of our objectives and goals. So the first one then is the formalization of businesses and their identity, and the second one is to encourage the maintenance of high standards of corporate governance, transparency, and brand protection in South Africa. And we have four KPIs that are listed, and our annual performance plan talks to these KPIs. So the first one would be the percentage of small businesses registered with CIPC. You will remember that the figure we're working from is 8.3. The local filings, we would like to see an increase of local filings in trademarks as a percentage of the total number of trademarks filed. We'd also, we will be issuing compliance certificates, and so the percentage of enterprises that receive compliance certificates talks to the reputation of that of those businesses. And then lastly, we'd like to see a percentage reduction in the number of name objections. What we think we need to do is develop more coherence around trademarks, corporate names, and business names which are registered in terms of the Consumer Protection Act. And if we see a reduction in the number of name objections, we think that there will have been more coherence in the evaluation of that. So we think that should actually add value to the economy, but it will probably take work away from lawyers. The second goal is around innovation and creativity promotion, and here we have two objectives. The one is to promote the protection and commercialization of innovation, and we think that we should focus the commercialization of innovations in key sectors, where as an economy we have a comparative advantage. And I think some of the policy documents of DTI and the Department of Science and Technology talk to that. So we would like to have a more focused strategy in that area. And then the second objective is to protect our cultural heritage and to support a strong and competitive South African creative industry that also provides benefits to local artists. It's easier said than done. We are responsible for regulating collecting societies, and it's been quite a challenging area. So our KPIs in this area are, again, we'd like to see an increase in the local filings in the intellectual property area in terms of patents and designs, as well as in films and video filings. We'd also like to see an increase in the percentage of registered patents with recorded license agreements. You will have noticed from, I think it's our APP, that currently it's 0.29%, and we think that there must be potential to increase that. And then we'd also like to initiate a system of voluntary recordal of Indigenous cultural expressions and creative works, and so we would like to measure our performance by a percentage increase in that. And then the third goal is around service delivery and access, and we have three objectives here. The first is to provide easy access to credible, reliable, and relevant information and advice, and secure value-added services to registered entities and rights holders. Secondly, is to build an enabling and intelligent work environment that's governed, that's anchored in a governed and sustainable organization. I see there's a spelling error there, I apologize. And then the third objective is to improve the reputation and the organizational performance of the CIPC. So this is an explicit focus on organizational excellence. I won't go through the detail of the KPIs. They are contained in both the strategy, and then the APP talks to that. So in previous sessions, the committee has asked us for benchmarking, and this is not exhaustive, but we thought we would just present a snapshot to you. The first question is benchmark against which countries. We have in the area of corporate registry, we tend to benchmark against the countries that do best in that global ease of doing business survey. And on the other side, I think in our last engagement, one of the members asked about comparisons with BRICS countries. So we've only identified India's results. Russia, I think, is in a different order of magnitude. And it's quite interesting when you look at the diversity of the sizes of the economy and the population,
So it makes it actually quite hard to compare. I think that's the point we would like to make, and that we need to be quite selective but also quite careful when we compare ourselves. There's some interesting information that we found from the World Bank. One of them is the enterprise density. And you'll see that a country like New Zealand has a very high, relatively high enterprise density. That means there are 17 enterprises for, and these are registered enterprises, registered companies with limited liability. 17 companies, registered companies per 1,000 of the population. South Africa's number is very low, and I think it's because they excluded closed corporations from the calculation. We tried to replicate the calculation, but I think we actually need to engage with the World Bank to get the number. When we looked at the number of the current register that includes closed corporations, we get to a number of 24, which would be very high. So I think we need to, I don't think that the number of 0.77 is really indicative. It would indicate, however, if this number is correct, that there is a lot, there must be a large opportunity for formalization of businesses. And then when you look at the ease of doing business, you'll notice that India and Brazil don't do particularly well. It's ranked out of 183 countries. So they are at the bottom end of the spectrum, and we are much higher up. But, you know, Rwanda is not far away from us. They are ranked 45th, although it's a much, much smaller economy. The survey also talks to some best practice around starting a business, and I just wanted to emphasize here that starting a business, when they measure you around the time it takes to start a business, it's not just the registration of that business, it's also the registration of tax and labor requirements. So it's very important for us as an institution, but also as a country, that we get that right. So we are working with SARS as fast as they are on that, and will continue to do so in this year. But South Africa at the moment, compared to the best performers, is not doing that well. But overall, as a country, we've done quite well at rank 35th. And the same when we come to the detail of registering a company. This was 2010 data, and it indicated that a company was registered in 15 days. I think in the past, or in the current financial year, that was not always a turnaround time, as I'm sure you're aware, but I think that is the turnaround time we're getting to again now. And maybe I can just add here that all the backlogs on new company registrations have been cleared. So we should be reaching this standard now. All right, there are some comparative statistics around patents, and I think the only thing you can study these, the only thing maybe to mention is that we are quite closely aligned with New Zealand and with Brazil. India is a bit of an anomaly, it seems, from these statistics. But I think the biggest difference is not when we look at the number of patents granted. The biggest difference is actually when we look at the number of patents filed, which is the next slide. So you will notice that in many of these countries, they receive a lot more filings, and they receive a lot more filings from domestic sources than we do. That's why we think that there is potential for us to increase that. And then I think there was also a question around universities in our last parliamentary session. I think there was other information that was requested as well that we haven't got yet, but that we will present in future. So please feel free to ask us any questions about this. Just lastly then, the budget. Our budget is, of course, a completely different order of magnitude than the Consumer Commission. But we are a self-sustaining institution. We generate our revenue ourselves. This is our budget for the next 5 years, and then we also have projected income. We've organized our budget according to the three programs, and the three programs are aligned with the strategic goals.
So I think what's important to mention here is that we think we will have some special initiatives over the next 3 years. We might be able to cut that back further because we think it's very important that we find operational efficiencies as an organization. We will be spending more on staff because we need to increase our establishment. So a lot of our expenditure will be on staff. We're projecting that there will be a shortfall in our revenue over the next 5 years, but we will fill that shortfall with reserves. And we will probably also have to consider some fee increases, not on the company side, but in the intellectual property side, from 2013 onwards. There's not a huge need, but we think we need to start preparing for it, and we need to review our operating model and our whole our fee structure and our revenue base. And it's something that we're going to be looking at in the next financial year. What we don't want to do is increase fees for new registration, so we also would like to restructure our fees. I know they were restructured on the company side for the new legislation, but we think there's opportunity also for further rationalization. This is the breakdown for the next financial year by program, where program one is business regulation and reputation, program two is innovation and creativity promotion, and program three is service delivery and access. And of course, all the IT expenditure and the building, the rental, all the most of the administrative expenditure sits in program three, which is why it is so big. So if you look at the allocation in a pie chart, I think the third service delivery and access, the percentage of the total budget is 56%, and business regulation and reputation is 30%, and innovation and creativity takes 14%. Of the budget. That's, of course, not all of it is in administration. In fact, 44% of our budget will be spent on staff-related expenditure, and I include in that not just salaries, but any bonus scheme that we have or performance-related bonus. Staff training, which we think a lot of emphasis needs to be on, as well as interns. And then there is the administrative expenditure, which would include, for example, our IT licenses, software licenses, the rentals. Then program expenditure, which includes any additional research that we want to do, that we outsource, education and awareness, where we bring outside service providers and also outsourced IT services. And then special projects, that takes up 18% of the budget. So at a high level, this is the breakdown by program. We've tried to link it with some of the outputs to give you a flavor of what it is. And I think maybe given the time constraints, Chair, would you like us to talk to this or shall we leave this for questions? So in the area of business regulation and reputation, most of the expenditure is on staff, and that is because that's the nature of our work. It is about receiving applications, processing applications, verifying information, and it's about investigating complaints and ensuring compliance. So our emphasis next year will be on improving the verification of the information we receive, improving our turnaround times on both registrations and investigations, building a compliance, beginning to build a compliance culture in the area of corporate conduct. And in order to do this, we will be issuing compliance certificates, as I already mentioned. We're also going to be developing full accreditation schemes for business rescue practitioners, but also for intermediaries that transact with us. We think there needs to be regulation. And then we will also be focusing on building separate registers for directors and for delinquent directors and business names. Again, there needs to be a lot of emphasis on staff training because a lot of our staff in this area is fairly administrative, at an administrative level, and we need to enhance the capacity and knowledge. And then there's program expenditure, which is largely focused on education and awareness. as well as on research, and we need to have a litigation budget. We need to anticipate that when we investigate and prosecute matters, there will be a litigation. On innovation and creativity, again, there's a predicted staff number. And then the, again, program expenditure that's outlined there. Service delivery. What we need to do here is we need to actually build our IT capacity, internal capacity. But in the interim, we will co-source externally. We need to focus on channel management, on our partners, because we won't be able to reach everybody on our own. We need partners, and so we need to focus. We need to have a focused competency on channel management. Information management, we don't have any resources there at the moment, and it's a big issue, ensuring that our data is data cleansing, data integrity, and also analyzing the data. And then governance, we need to enhance our governance. We need to build a forensic auditing section that can investigate any complaints that we receive about inside conduct or external conduct. So, and then here is where our special project budget is. As well, it's about short-term ICT upgrades, data cleansing, and then moving to a new building, which we need to budget for. So in conclusion, strategy, as I said at the beginning, this is an emerging document. We think of this as a journey, not a destination. We also believe that organizations don't execute. It's the people in it that do, and so we need to continue working with our staff, on our staff, and we need to ensure that that we can build together confidence and commitment. And then lastly, we have a quote which we think sums up our current year, financial year, but also what we think we will be experiencing over the next 4 years. And that is a quote from Nelson Mandela, which is that I have discovered that after climbing a great hill, one only finds that there are many more to climb. I can only rest for a minute, for with freedom comes responsibility, and I dare not linger, for my long walk is not yet ended. We think we still have a long walk ahead of us, but we're confident that we're doing it from a solid foundation. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Honourable members, I think that we did receive the start plans last week, and then it was our duty to go through them meticulously before we came here. I think that what has happened again is that she highlighted really what is inside those start plans. So the issue now is on our side. We have to engage with that. We know that the CIPC is the home affairs of our economy. Without these companies, our economy is going to collapse. So it's up to us to engage and assist when necessary. Honorable Clow will be the first one, followed by Honorable Wilma James, Honorable Albert, Honorable Kosi, number four. We can start with Honorable Clow.
Chairperson, thanks, Commissioner, for the good report. I just want to look at some area that I think is problematic. That businesses were saying there are no benefits, they don't enjoy benefits of registering. I think it's upon us to force them to register. Now, what comes to me here is registration versus law enforcement versus benefits and versus inspection. That by right we should be able to do inspection. And this reminds me of a report I have read elsewhere informally that South African breweries have got over a million outlets throughout the country, and only 10% of them are licensed. The rest of them are illegal business. It was pathetic for me to hear that story, that there is so much business going on in the country that we don't know of. The other area is the issue of registering these businesses actually works together with the knowledge of who we are and who is doing what in terms of business. And that would include spazas, little small businesses of fruits and vegetables that are always next to the street, to taverns, to government businesses. How are we doing in the registration of those? More particularly concerned from the communities is around the foreign small spazas that are all over the townships and squatter camps. Actually, the whole place in the rural areas, all over. That retail business of selling the day-to-day needs to the people, the sugar and seeds and paraffin and whatever. All the majority of those businesses, if not all of them, are run by foreigners in South Africa today. Where are we in terms of those? Do we simply look at them as illegal business? Is there a way to register? Are these people here in this country legally or illegally? Those are the two questions, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just wanted to congratulate you on the presentation, in addition to the documentation that we studied. The figures you give, I mean, in terms of the challenge we face as a country, in part has to do with the period it takes to start a business. And you've provided very interesting comparative statistics here. So that's very good. So we can have a benchmark. Singapore clearly is a kind of cloud leader in this, and if one looks closely at what they do, they've developed a simple system using e-government, which means you need that e-government platform in order to do this. Now, if you look at the number of places a South African wishing to start a business has to stop, they have to lodge their documentation with the Companies Commission, register with SARS, register with the Department of Labor, register with the relevant commissioner under the Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Diseases Act. Those are all the places, there are probably more. So what one requires is a single form and a single one-stop shop in order to do that. Now, Singapore has done that, and we've looked at it very closely in the case of the Western Cape government, wishing to introduce that system here provincially. So I think, and I don't mention that for any purpose other than saying that we're experimenting with that system in the Western Cape. So it would be very interesting to know what those numbers would look like provincially. That is, how long does it take to start a business in different provinces in the country? Because that will focus the attention more rigorously on where the challenges reside if you look at the variation within the country. Thank you.
Honorable Albert.
Thank you, Chair. Yes. Thank you for your presentation. It's very comprehensive. It's well done. Just to add to the previous Honorable Speaker, Honorable Jones, the view that we need a one-stop shop, I think that's something that needs to be investigated to increase our competitiveness internationally. Then I also would like to know, I've noticed that in contrast with the Cipro, that when one goes onto your website, we have to pay to get access to any information. Before, there was certain information that was freely available. For instance, if you wanted to find out who the directors of a company were, then you could actually see that online before, but now you can't. You have to apply officially. I just want to get a sense of your policy regarding payment and, you know, also taking into account the fact that many people you deal with don't have the necessary finances to pay for that. Then, with regards to the patent system, well, actually, before I go there, with regards to the small businesses, do you have any action plan how to reach small businesses and get them to formalize themselves? And then, lastly, with regards to patents itself, have you done any research regarding South Africa's patent trends? What type of patents are being filed? to get intelligence so that we can get an understanding of our innovation path in South Africa, so that we can also use that information to make sure that we become more innovative in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I would also like to congratulate the Commissioner on the report. And it's clear that we have moved a long way from Cyprus to where we are. But I think everything comes with it, all with different challenges. On page 5, on the regulatory trend, you mentioned that the emergence of low-cost manufacturing developing countries such as China have changed the IT landscape. And I think perhaps I would want to know perhaps how do you deal with that? Because we have also noticed that we're getting lots of imports and in terms of standards as well. And here I know that you have to work with other units such as SAPS and SARS as well, and how you deal with that, because we have all these relationships with these countries, but it impacts on patency and also the standards, how you deal with that. The second one is on intent. I'm interested to know, I can see a lot of money is being spent on intent. Where and how do you recruit your intent? And what happens to them afterwards, because they are paid for a particular period? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Members. I think from the start of the chair, I'll also commend the strat plan itself. I think that it's short, but comprehensive. And then I think that also highlighted the challenges of the economy, national and international. But what is also critical, I like the idea of the IT. That issue of sales of around 7 trillion rand per annum shows that it's a very big business. Yeah. What I'd like to know on your side, since we passed that IT bill, are you systems in place so that when the president signs off that bill, be able to really to register the traditional knowledge so that it can be part of the mainstream kind of IT? And then number two, we'll also go to the issue of the company hijacks. Yeah. I think that people had a serious problem around that. And then, but this issue now is also international, at the international level. And then with your interaction, do you also involve the agencies like the intelligence in the process in dealing with those issues? And then also, I thought that you're also going to highlight the issue that South Africa is ranked number 10 when coming to the protection of the investment from the outsider. I think that one is an achievement. On our side, I think that must be highlighted. How do you do that? Né? I think that if you can expand, because we need a lot of good news in South Africa. Né? Thank you. What's your commission?
Thank you, Chair. I think I will ask my colleagues to answer, and then I'll come in.
Thank you, Commissioner, and Honourable Chairperson. On the issue of the area around small business and our action plan to formalize some, sorry, I'm going to jump around some of those somewhat as I make quite a bit of notes. We see our role within the broader context also of the DTI family of playing very much a coordinating role as far as gathering statistics is concerned around small business activity and where we should be targeting our audience to and our education strategies accordingly. What the DTI has done, and I attended a meeting just recently whereby the DTI has initiated a small business project survey. It's a survey where they want to look at the landscape of small businesses, interact with them on the level of stats gathering, as well as look at what their needs and the capacity is concerned. We've wrote to many agencies, like Stats is a present, SARS has been present, and therefore we can get a holistic picture of what the objectives of what we hope to achieve, as well as where our target audience lies. Our strategy speaks to the heart of our education role and fulfilling those roles accordingly, because we believe that we play a two roles. One is that we must have the ease of business role, but also we must have a knowledge role, in the sense that we must educate people about what the benefits of registration are, the credibility of the increasing the credibility of their organizations and their businesses, as well as their access to certain funds and as part of being part of the formal economy. So we're very much active in the role of segmentation and finding out exactly the type of businesses and the activity, as well as the provincial activity that's involved in that, together with our mother department, the DTI, and therefore we can have targeted education campaigns, as well as targeted drives by virtue of our partnerships like CEDA and NIDA, NYDA, and therefore open access along those channels accordingly. When it comes to the issue of, and the Honourable Member Kosi asked a question about the impact of the IP landscape and China aspect, the issue around how do we deal with this area, we look at it in two ways. The one is we're very much active in the role of anti-counterfeiting of goods. It's one of our mandates. You'll see it as part of our strategic plan that we are responsible for the Counterfeit Goods Act, and therefore we have inspectors that go out and play a coordinating role, as well as the education role as far as SARS and Customs is concerned, and the South African Police Service, as well as industry players as far as curbing that type of behavior. But what we would like to see is that, and we think our role extends even further than that, in that we want to look at how we educate in the innovation space. So we see also the academic area of educating parties around the area of IP, the whole benefits of IP, as well as growing that domestic, as the Commissioner rightly stated, growing that domestic filing and domestic interest in local innovation. So we see our space as one of curbing the counterfeiting area, but also increasing knowledge around the innovation aspect of our domestic market to curb the challenges that are faced by us in getting all of these goods entering our economy accordingly. The issue of the benefit of registration, as stated by the Honourable Member Salao, is that we need to look at the value proposition for these businesses. We need to see exactly what type of service we should be doing as far as ease of business and ease of them registering, but also we want to have sustainable business. I think most importantly, sustainability is at the forefront of what we like to achieve. We don't see, and this is where trade possibly comes in, we don't see value in many businesses coming into the formal economy if they leave the formal economy fairly quickly, without them being sustainable. So we need to attract businesses and let them know exactly what the proposition is of coming in order for them to realize that with formalization comes many benefits, such as credibility of your business, access to finance, because then you'll be seen to be part of the formal economy, and we also look at it as building the reputation of those businesses by the issue of increasing their compliance. So we see many aspects of us playing a role as far as that value proposition is concerned, and therefore we need to speak, and our education needs to speak to the heart of those type of businesses being brought into the formal economy. It takes a lot of work, because as you see from the study that was done by FinScope, many people do not see the benefits around it. So our education must be targeted specifically to make them realize and understand that this is where formalization leads and this is where formalization benefits lie. We see also our role as far as the spread of our education campaigns by using our relationships with other agencies. So as the Commission stated in the strategic plan, we need to have a presence within 40 kilometers of active communities, and therefore they need to be have an ease of access by us being available to them in order to deal with the registration, as well as the informational needs that they have. But we classify our customers on various levels, but most importantly on a transactional level, people that want to register, or on an informational level, people who want to know what the registration is all about, and therefore the benefits that flow from registration. So we need to have partnerships as far as that is concerned. We need to have a footprint in terms of the landscape of South Africa and being accessible, as we say, within 40 kilometers of active communities for them to be able to access our services as far as that is concerned. When it comes to the issue of the period to start a business and the benchmarking with e-government platforms, as raised by the Honourable James, is that Singapore is definitely a benchmark for us, or it's actually a world benchmark in terms of all registrars, including New Zealand, as far as the issue of how easy it is to do business there. But the one thing that's most important is that we've also realized that we need to have this one-stop-shop approach. So we have projects running with SARS currently in terms of the movement of data and the movement of registration data in order to alleviate that they need to do multiple registrations as far as that is concerned. And we also have some surveys and some projects running as far as that is concerned. There is a project currently called the Business Registration Reform Project, which brings together all of these entities into one space, and therefore we look at the flow of information as well as the ease of registration as far as that is concerned. But what we've done is taken a bit of a big bang approach, and we as a CIPC said that we would like to see some incremental stages in that project in order for the benefit to flow almost immediately. So the one thing that we would like to look at firstly is the linking of the registers. The linking of, for example, the SARS tax register together with the CIPC register, and therefore look at how the information can flow between those registers as far as registration needs and information needs are concerned. And that project is currently running. We meet with SARS on a very regular basis as far as that is concerned, and we all understand that we need to make business easier for people. It's no use, for example, a company having to change its address and then pitching up at three different offices to do exactly the same thing. It doesn't make any sense. It should go to one office, and that information, for example, a change of address, should flow to all the others. And therefore, we understand it, and therefore, we're targeting that type of response as far as the reduction of those burdens are concerned. Therefore, there is projects running in that space, and therefore, we're enhancing as far as that is concerned. As far as the issue of interns and our recruitment of interns, the recruitment of interns is done on an advertising basis. We advertise in as far as newspapers are concerned, and then there can be applications made accordingly, and obviously we filter down and therefore we see exactly what the requirements are as far as recruitment is concerned. I think our strategy going forward will obviously be one of evaluating the interns after performance, and therefore seeing how we can best utilize them in the organization as far as that is concerned. So it's an evaluation process of how they perform over the period of their internship. I think I've just got one more to add. As far as the IT bill is concerned, yes, we very much have a project running as far as what we colloquially call the traditional knowledge and indigenous knowledge, but what is known as the Intellectual Property Amendment Bill. We very much gearing ourselves up towards a recordal system in terms of being active in the communities to record the indigenous knowledge that lies within the South African space. But we've also done one step prior to that, is that we obviously need to first educate our community. So we have a whole project as far as education around IP is concerned, and we've already started that. I know some of my colleagues have spoken to Consulesa, have been out to various communities and municipalities, and therefore have engaged as far as that this bill is going to be signed. We need to be active in the space, and therefore the record of the venture starts. We've budgeted for it as far as the entity is concerned, and therefore we see it as us playing a very active role as far as the IP amendment bill is concerned.
Could be there, is something you'd like to add? Okay, so let me just come in and maybe deal with a few issues that I think still require addressing. On the registration of businesses, registration with us isn't compulsory. Because when you register a company, you get limited liability. So there's an advantage that we need to sell. But in certain forms of registration are compulsory. So in order to operate in an area, you need municipal approvals. And I think, for example, in liquor, you need both the municipal approval in terms of the Businesses Act and then also a liquor license. You don't necessarily need to be registered with CIPC. But I think there is a big issue around compliance in general. And it's been around, it is maybe part of our history, a political history as well. And it's something I think that's changed a lot since 1994. I think as a country, there has been, you know, we've seen more registration, more formalization, for example, in the liquor area. But I think there's lots that still needs to be done. What we think we need to do, Rory talked about the value proposition, and we think that is a critical thing. And I think actually there's a huge opportunity for us to work quite closely with the Consumer Commission, because I think it is about the reputation of businesses, and consumers need to vote to which businesses they're going to go, which businesses they're going to support. And they should be supporting those businesses that behave well, that are registered, that comply with the laws of the country, and also, you know, respect consumers. So I think it's one of the things that's been in the back of my mind, certainly, that we need to work together with the Consumer Commission around maybe some kind of reputation model for businesses. I just want to add on the issue of Singapore, that it's not just Singapore, it's New Zealand, and I think Australia, I don't think, has done it. But the countries that do very well in the ease of doing business register survey and ranking are countries that have a good e-governance framework. And what that means is that somebody verifies your identity, and then you can transact with anybody in government. We are working on something like that in South Africa, but I think what we want to do next year is focus on that upfront verification of all the customers, and then everything else should become easier afterwards, and we think we can improve our turnaround times on that. Also, if we get that customer verification right, SARS can rely on it, or we need to work with SARS, because that's the critical thing. It's around the verification of the identity and certain critical issues such as the address. Patent system, we're not currently analyzing the data that we have, and we don't collect the information in a way that makes it easy. The analysis has to be a manual process. So, but we are aware of that, and what we are planning for next year is that we do more research in this area. We have to. It's one of the key things that we need to be able to use the information that we have, make that available for policy and even for commercial decisions. But the problem with making some of the information available, certainly around directors, are the privacy issues and the fact that people are using some of that information for fraud. So we're going to be reviewing our own internal protocols around it. We're already starting to restrict information. But you're absolutely right. We need to get the balance right. It's something that we're going to be doing, focusing on this year, the balance right between making available information freely and for free, and certain more specialized information that we think we will make available at a fee when there's more analysis. Even in the intellectual property area, you can do initial searches for free, and then other more detailed searches are charged for. And I think that's also an international phenomenon. But I think we need to make a lot more services available to the public for free, even on the registration side. And that's when we review our fees will be the emphasis. Maybe just to add on the interns, just to add to what Rory said, we see the interns as almost as an explicit recruitment strategy for the organization. So what we want to do is we want to bring in a set of people, and we want to be able to absorb the best people after a year. It will reduce our recruitment cost and recruitment time, and it will also give people the opportunity to get jobs. And we will have been able to review their performance for a year. So we think it's quite good. And just one thing I wanted to add on the IT bill. Rory mentioned the budget. I think our budget for it is $10 million. It's a defined education strategy. It's developing the IT capacities for the recording system. What we actually want to do is video. Is go out, so what we've budgeted for is that we can go out and actually record, we can record by video the Indigenous knowledge or the claims. And then we're also planning in conjunction with DTI to establish a specialist committee. And Mathilde, I've discussed it with Mathilde and yourself, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Because we think what work needs to be done to actually develop the processes, the procedures for evaluating claims, IP claims, and that is work that the council will have to do. But we think that we can do some preparatory work this year. So so that we are ready. And then lastly, on company hijackings, yes, the intelligence agencies, we need to work with the intelligence agencies on this. We don't at the moment, but it is something that we are going to be doing. And then I think we will, we took your point about the fact that we ranked 10th chair to heart. I think it's something that we need to promote a lot more.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Any follow-up? If there's none, there's no need to raise any. All right. Honourable Silao, anyone? 1, 2, 3, 4.
Following up on what you earlier said, at that time is up.
All right. Thank you, Honourable Silao. You know, our time was supposed to be 11, and then our tea time was supposed to be only 5 minutes. We came back around 11:15. That's why I gave the extension for that. So that one will cascade into the following presentation. Instead of one, go to Arakura about one. Thanks a lot to Commissioner and your team for the wonderful work you are doing. And then I think that the department is supporting you. We must continue to support you, and ourselves will do the same. Because that's doing wonderful work. Thanks a lot. Can the National Credit Regulator, now we are coming to the oxygen of our economy. Without credit, there is no economy to speak about. We need that. All right, Honourable Members, I think that the NCR is ready for the presentation. I think it's led by the chairperson, Mr. Bailey. Yeah. And then I'll request you to introduce your team, and then you just fire on because we're pressed for time. All right.
And thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Yes, as the Chair indicated, my name is Trevor Bailey, and I'm the recently appointed chairperson of the Board of the National Credit Regulator. On my immediate left is the acting CEO, Nonsama Shingari, and we also have with us next to Mr. Shingari and Ms. Shidi Makhwadi, who's the acting financial manager. Honourable Chair, how we propose this to deal with the presentation is, because this is the first time that this particular board is appearing before this committee, I'm going to talk for a very brief period of time. I have handed out a document which I'm assuming is in the possession of the members, which will just talk very generally to the current landscape and again talk very briefly to what the NCR does. And thereafter, I'm going to hand over to the acting CEO then to deal with the nuts and bolts and to present that draft plan to you, if that's in order, Honourable Chair.
Well, no, that would be fine, as long as we're going to, by at least by one, if the whole presentation is finished.
Well, we're going to do our best. And thank you very much. Then just, if I can just start off by saying that the current board was appointed at the end of October. We're currently made up of a chairperson and six members. Additional members are in the process of being appointed and are currently undergoing the personal verification and security checks. Now, the credit industry in South Africa continues to face unprecedented challenges and scrutiny. Although the global economic lockdown had little primary impact in South Africa, it nevertheless caused a massive contraction in the granting of credit and has resulted in greater stress to over-indebted consumers. In South Africa, the build-up in mortgage arrears continues, coupled with a continued contraction in the granting of housing loans. This results in not only fewer buyers and debt-stressed borrowers being unable to sell their properties, but more significantly, a decline in housing construction and a damage to housing delivery. It is therefore not surprising that over the last few years in South Africa has seen a shift from housing lending to consumer credit. Currently, South African credit providers extend more consumer credit than housing loans. This has alarming implications for South Africa's future economic growth, particularly given the possibility of a double-dip recession elsewhere in the world. Now, NCR research shows that the total value of unsecured loans by the third quarter of 2011 rose by 53% to 101.1 billion rand from the previous year. This represents 8% of all lending in South Africa and is up from 5.7% in 2010. Moreover, the number of secured credit accounts dropped 1% and unsecured accounts rose 51% in the 12 months to September 2011. Almost 75% of unsecured credit consisted of loans of more than 15,000 rand, and more than 60% of those loans went to people earning less than 10,000 rand a month. Now, according to an economist at Investec Bank, Annabel Bishop, anecdotal evidence suggests that borrowers are using unsecured credit to finance consumption and repay other debts. This is a trend that is not sustainable unless wage increases climb significantly above inflation. In short, Ms. Bishop suggests that the growth of unsecured lending may fuel spending and inflation, causing interest rates to rise more than expected. In the midst of these challenges lies the NCR. It continues to regulate the South African credit industry. Its role in regulating debt restructuring and counselling has successfully mediated the process of debt stress, and it has created an orderly mechanism for over-indebted consumers to restructure payment of their indebtedness. The NCR can be justifiably proud of having registered more than 2,000 debt counsellors, and the positive steps it has taken in establishing a functional debt counselling system with a full set of guidelines. Now, recent court cases have weakened the ability of the NCR to regulate the process of debt stress, and it will be necessary in the future to amend the National Credit Act. The NCR performs an important role in developing and augmenting knowledge of the South African consumer credit industry through its publications, statistics, and its research projects. The NCR's Consumer Credit Report and Credit Bureau Monitor are highly respected publications in the credit industry. If knowledge equals power, then education is the best representation that consumers will have to enforce their rights. The NCR continues to achieve its consumer education mandate through its extensive consumer awareness program, which includes the dissemination of information through various media. In its relatively short existence, the NCR has radically overhauled the regulation of the credit industry in South Africa. The NCR aims to ensure that the credit industry is efficient, that it's professional, that it's equitable, and that it is lawful. The NCR has raised the bar concerning the enforcement of credit legislation in South Africa and has successfully changed the behaviour of credit providers through its enforcement actions in both the courts and at the National Consumer Tribunal. In short, then, the NCR has an integral role to play in ensuring a financially strong, well-governed and viable credit sector in South Africa's financial services landscape. The recently appointed board members and the dedicated staff of the NCR has continued to release the seed of creative energy within it to meet this challenge. Thank you, Honourable Chair. At this point, I think it makes sense for me to hand over to the acting CEO.
Thanks a lot, Honourable
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, Honourable Members. This is an overview of the presentation and the vision, mission, and values. Excuse me, this is moving too quickly. Excuse me. Okay, the overview, this is the overview of the presentation. I will not, you know, go through the list because we need to move with speed. And in terms of our vision as the National Credit Regulator, our vision is to promote a South African consumer credit market that is fair, transparent, accessible, and dynamic. And I want to emphasize the especially, you know, accessible, but also dynamic because it's still evolving. And our mission is to support the social and economic advancement of South Africa by regulating for a fair and non-discriminatory market for access to consumer credit and promoting responsible, and I want to emphasize the word responsible, credit granting used and effectively addressed. Our values for service excellence, integrity, empowerment, both empowering our partners, visa registrants and other key stakeholders, but also good corporate governance. Now, we have taken four high-level strategic objectives. We are going to operationalize this, which means in each area of the credit regulator, we'll have more than, four strategic objectives, but this is at a very high level. To promote increased access to credit through responsible credit granting, to protect consumers from abuse and unfair practices in the consumer credit market and address over-indebtedness. Honourable Members, this is really the main aim of the National Credit Act. To continue and enhance the consumer credit market regulatory framework and to monitor and improve NCR's effectiveness into fulfilling its mandate. What we've done is that we try to align our strategic objectives with, you know, government priorities. We all understand that the government has committed itself to achieving 12 outcomes between 2009 and 2014. And in his State of the Nation address, His Excellency Jacob Zuma, the President, featured job creation and reduction in poverty prominently in his speech. The outcome 4 is decent employment through inclusive economic growth, ties in very closely with the, you know, our objectives. The activities of the NCR are mostly closely associated with contributing to outcome 4, which is really about job creation. And in terms of the strategic alignment to government and the DTI priorities, the alignment between outcomes of the NCR seeks to achieve and the strategic objectives of the DTI is set out in terms of output, outcomes, possible challenges, and financial implications, and I'll take you through all of that. The first objective of the NCR, which ties in with the first objective of the DTI, is to promote increased access to credit through responsible credit granting. And that ties in or is aligned with facilitating broad-based economic participation through targeted interventions to achieve more inclusive economic growth. Now, in terms of outcomes, We want to have increased access to credit for historically disadvantaged persons. We are emphasizing this because we, as the NCR, have really not done much in this area, and that's the reason why, you know, I mean, NCR has been in existence since 2006. We feel that it's time now that we started, you know, making sure that there's increased access to credit for historically disadvantaged persons, but at reduced levels of over-indebtedness. That is very important. We do a research on access. We've already done a research actually on access to credit for historical disadvantaged persons, but it covers a whole range of other groupings. The report that, you know, that has been drafted is still being evaluated. And also this talks to the establishment of the National Register of Credit Agreements, which is provided for by the National Credit Act. Possible challenges in terms of this particular objective. The chairperson has already highlighted our concerns, issues around unsecured credit. There's been a shift in the consumer credit market in that you now find that there's more credit that goes towards unsecured lending at the cost of mortgage loans. And the reverse was, you know, reflected in 2007. We've seen that there's more and more money now, you know, more credit granted towards unsecured credit. But I'll show you the graph that illustrates that. And possible over-indebtedness and reckless lending. We are worried about this because unsecured credit carries the highest interest rate in terms of the Act. Low or non-response from credit providers, that might be a challenge for us, but obviously what this means is that we need to engage a lot, you know, and run workshops with credit providers. Incorrect, incomplete information received. And honorable members, I just want to show you what is happening in terms of the shift that is happening in the consumer credit market. In December 2007, 51% of the 1 trillion industry then, 51% was going towards mortgages and 7.75% was granted towards unsecured credit. If you fast forward that to today, well, at September 2011, we see that, you know, from 7% unsecured credit now constitutes 22%, 21.45%, and mortgage loans have come down to 6% of the 1.27 trillion industry today. That has been reported on today. And if you talk about unsecured credit, as I indicated, unsecured credit as a percentage of the total gross debtors book constitutes 8%. However, it is the one credit product that has been growing at an alarming rate. It grew at 52.78% year on year, and it's the highest when you compare it with other credit products. Even though, you know, as I indicated, it constitutes 8% of the total, you know, gross debtors book. On our one-on-one meetings with the banks, when we engaged with them to try and understand why they are going that route, was that it's unprofitable now to grant credit towards mortgages. Secondly, there because of the Basel requirements that require them as banks to hold more cash, you know, that's the reason why they've gone this route. Because banks are now targeting, if you will recall, under the exemption notice, credit providers were limited to personal loans up to 10,000 repayable over a period of 36 months. Now, with the, you know, with the introduction of the National Credit Act, they're allowed to give, you know, as much credit as they want. But what we picked up that the majority of this credit, you would find that one individual is able to get now 200,000-300,000 over 72 months. But then they also said, you know, they are now able to target sectors that were not targeted before, you know, by the bank. And therefore there's increased access to credit because of that. In terms of the debt review process, once a consumer is under debt review, payment that goes towards mortgages and other credit types are treated the same. So you might find that, you know, your store cards and other personal loans get paid before your installment towards your mortgage loan is paid, which in effect might mean that you might end up not being able to service your mortgage loan. And they're saying, you know, with house prices, you know, that are down, that are, you know, that have been reduced, it's very difficult for them to even repossess houses and sell them. because first of all, they are not in the business of repossession. Secondly, it needs a way to repossess. People don't have money these days to, you know, to buy house cash. And not everybody is able to get 100%, you know, loan, you know, to buy a house. So those are some of the challenges that they have, you know, they have communicated to us. We have sensitized the Reserve Bank, we have sensitized Treasury, we have sensitized the Banking Association. We've had one-on-one meetings. Over and above that, we are also conducting a study in unsecured credit to understand what the drivers are and what it is that we can do, you know, the recommendations that we will be making to the Department of Trade Industry in terms of what, you know, what should happen in this space. But we are worried, obviously, as the National Credit Regulator. Remedies for challenges in terms of objective one, financial literacy from primary level. We want to start engaging with children, kids at primary level to educate them on, you know, credit. Because we believe, you know, it is through, you know, if we start at a very early age to instill this in the minds of small children, we will then go a long way, you know, in ensuring that our education programs, you know, work. Target the public sector and conduct a study on over-indebtedness. That's a research that we'll be embarking on. NCR messaging on public servants pays it. We've already started with this particular initiative in the sense that if you look at the public servants, you know, or public service employees pay it, we've got a message, NCR messages at the bottom. Because we picked up that in the majority of those people, government employees that are over-indebted, these are your nurses, your doctors, your teachers, your nurses that are really, you know, have a lot of debt. They may not all be over-indebted, but they, you know, definitely have a lot of debt. And NCR messages on, yeah, on public service basis, meetings with banks, Treasury, BAFA, and the Reserve Bank to sensitize them about this. And as a result of our engagement with the Reserve Bank, they've also undertaken to do a similar study, so we will be combining efforts to try and really find out what is happening in the unsecured lending space and conduct a study here to inform policy once all of that is done. Now, in terms of the financial implications, I'm going to ask the, our acting finance manager at the end of the presentation to take you through the budget. But let me get on with the next objective, which is to protect consumers from abuse and unfair practices in the consumer credit market and address over-indebtedness. And that ties in and is aligned with, you know, the DTI objective, which is to create a fair regulatory environment that enables investment, trade and enterprise development in an equitable and socially responsible manner. Our outcomes here are, you know, increased credit understanding of consumer rights in terms of the National Credit Act, decreased levels of non-compliance with the provisions of the National Credit Act, and that helps to, you know, consumer rights as the output. Consumer rights awareness strategy, we want to do also embark on an enforcement strategy and a stakeholder strategy. Let me just point out that we have these strategies in place. We have been in existence since 2006. The Act was implemented in 2007. We already do a lot of media. We work very close with the media in terms of radio interviews, TV interviews, and newsprint. We run a number of workshops with government, trade unions, and employers. We do a lot of, you know, education campaigns with the South African Savings Institute, with the Ombud Schemes, with the Banking Association of South Africa, you know, with the DTI. And we also do have an enforcement strategy. What all that you are saying is that we need to revisit this because obviously there's been, as I said, the credit, consumer credit market in South Africa is evolving. And we also need to start thinking of new ways of communicating our messages. It can't be business as usual because as we have seen, there's been a shift in the market space and we need to come up with creative ways of, you know, sending out, you know, messages to consumers and enforcing the Act. And you will have seen that in the first year, that's what we will be busy with, you know, coming up, revisiting our strategies to come up with new strategies in terms of, you know, enforcement, stakeholder strategy, and consumer rights awareness strategies. And our outcomes, as I indicated, they are increased credit understanding, you know, of consumer rights. Our challenges in achieving, you know, these objectives. Constraints in relation to resources, capacity, we are still operating under capacity. We have become, as the NCR, the training ground for credit providers, especially the banks. What we have done is that we have set up a learnership program. We have We got in 10 learners at the beginning of the year. We will be bringing in new learners in the new financial year. What we want to do with the current learners, because they are here for a period of 12 months, is that in terms of our organizational design, we are going to introduce, new vacancies that, and so that we can pull them in and they become, they're given permanent jobs, to use that as a pool where we feel, we have capacity issues. Delays in processing matters referred by the NCR for prosecution. You will recall that the tribunal for some time could not impose fines. So there were matters that we could not, refer to the tribunal, but we have started doing that because now they have, those powers to start imposing fines. As the NCR, the only thing that we can do as an enforcement, to enforce the act, is either to get the credit providers or debt counselors or credit bureaus to write letters of undertaking to say they will fix things, or we issue a compliance notice. In the event that the registrant does not comply with the compliance notice, we then refer the matters to the tribunal or the court. But then we are relying on the turnaround times, at the tribunal and at the court to be able to, speedily deal with our enforcement matters. NCR presence in rural and underserved communities. We have challenges especially in communicating our messages, especially rural areas. But what we have done is that we have started working very closely with the DTI in terms of the contra letter, roadshows, and we have embarked on those, already started, those roadshows with the DTI. Relationship with the tribunal, we really want to have, to be able to engage on a regular basis with the tribunal, understanding that the tribunal is an independent body and they need to be independent. So that independence will be respected. But I think it's important for both of us to understand each other's processes. Changing financial laws in South Africa, there's talk now around, the proposed twin peak model. The government is looking to set up a prudential regulator and a market conduct regulator. And as to, and we are making you understand that FSB and Treasury are driving this. NCR has been invited to sit in a steering committee that looks at market conduct, because that's what the NCR does in terms of the Act. And at this point in time, the various working teams are looking at best practices to see how this model can be adapted in South Africa. So at this point in time, it's still a work in progress, but we don't know, what's going to happen eventually. Potential jurisdictional overlaps with the NCC-NCR. We've already met with the commissioner to look at potential overlaps. And we know, especially with consumers, that there's still a confusion in our minds, in the sense that they can't distinguish between a complaint that is related to credit and a complaint that is related to what, the commissioner should be dealing with. So those are some of the messages that will be, tailor-making to make sure that there's that distinction. Remedies, initiate beneficial relationships with all, stakeholders. I did speak about the contra letter and House of Traditional Leaders that we'll be working closely with, and we've already started with the contra letter one. Currently investigating pilot satellite offices in two to three provinces, because we've only got one national office in Gauteng, and this is a big industry. We work very closely with the consumer affairs offices in the various provinces. However, we are investigating possibilities of setting up and the feasibility of setting up, satellite offices and piloting that in two or three provinces. We've already started, meeting with the post office and want to see if we can piggyback on existing structures without having to set up our own satellite office. So that is work in progress. Innovative education and communication initiatives, as I indicated, we need to look at new ways of communicating our messages to consumers and improve communication delivery channels. Obviously, we are looking at the technology that we have today, the social media. We may want to partner with, for instance, Vodacom or MTN to find out how we can use SMSs, to communicate information to consumers in, areas that we are not able to reach. the other remedies around really creating awareness with magistrates. We've been conducting magistrate training sessions, and we want to continue with that. The department, we are doing this in partnership with the Department of Justice. At least the main focus area here is death cancelling processes. Magistrates need to understand what processes they need to go through, you know, in dealing with death cancelling matters. Establish a fidelity fund and assist with high cost litigation costs for DC consumers and clients. Currently, as I said, as the NCR, the worst thing that can happen to a death counselor who does not comply with the Act is that we can only make a recommendation to the tribunal to get his or her registration cancelled. In the meantime, you might end up with somebody who's already lost their assets, and there's nothing you can do about that. So we must, you know, we are looking at establishment of the fidelity fund, but that would obviously require amendment of the Act, and it's one of the proposals that we are making in terms of the amendment of the Act. Regular stakeholder engagement, and then, as I said, the 80 finance manager will come to that. And in terms of strategic objective 3, to continually enhance a consumer-based market regulatory framework, and that helps to facilitate a broad-based economic participation through targeted intervention to achieve more inclusive economic growth. And our outcomes there, increased compliance and credit bureaus, I wanted that to stick out. Increased compliance by credit bureaus in terms of the National Credit Act and increased compliance with the regulatory framework, and that helps to more, you know, the credit providers. And our output would be credit bureau compliance. We'll be able to see that through assessment reports that we get on a regular basis and compliance with the regulatory framework enforced. Now, I have indicated in the, we have indicated in the threat then that we want to do 2 credit bureau investigations every year. We've only registered 11 credit bureaus, right? So we want to be able to do 2 credit bureau investigations each year. And credit bureau investigations are very complex, and these are big companies, and that's the reason why we really want to stay with the 2. Currently, we are busy with 1 big investigation relating to one of the biggest, you know, credit bureaus in South Africa. To try and see whether, in terms of the Act, remember, they are only allowed to source information from certain, you know, sources, and they can only sell to, you know, to certain entities. They can't willy-nilly, you know, buy information and sell it to, you know, anyone that they want. So those are some of the issues that we'll be looking at. Now, the challenges are inadequate reporting on the level of compliance from data sources. You're looking at issues of accuracy, validity, meeting submission dates. But I must just say, in terms of credit bureaus, we've never had challenges about, you know, their reporting to the NCR. They always report timely. In instances where they have challenges, they would ask for an extension. But yeah, I mean, the accuracy of the information is something that we will definitely need to concentrate on, that, and that's what we're doing in our current investigation with one of the biggest credit bureaus. The National Credit Act in itself poses a challenge in terms of enforcement. The National Credit Act was implemented, was became effective in 2007. We have tested it in the court. And some of the judgments that have been handed down were not handed down in favor of the NCR or the consumer. And we really don't believe that in some of those instances that was really the intention of the legislation. And we have taken some of these matters up to the Constitutional Court to make, you know, to make a statement. However, there are gaps in the National Credit Act, and we need to address those. So we are busy amending, you know, we are busy coming, you know, compiling proposals around, you know, what the key amendments that we'd like to see happen, and we will be making our recommendation to the DTI so that, you know, in that regard. We are aware that the DTI is already waiting on some of those amendments. And changing financial laws in South Africa, I've already spoken to the FinPIC model. And remedies, recommend amendments to the Act, adapt to changing financial laws, and we are saying if it means, you know, in terms of the FinPIC, the government sees that there has to be 1 market conduct regulator, you know, we will have to adapt and accept that as the NCR, because this is really not just about us. This is about the country, what is best for the country. And initiate stronger stakeholder relations. And in terms of strategic objective 2, our objective is
to strategic objectives to monitor and improve MCR's effectiveness in fulfilling its mandate. And the outcome is improved reputational and stakeholder satisfaction and improved operational efficiency. And that will lead to stakeholder, you know, we'll see that through the assessment that is going to be done, the surveys that are going to be conducted. We have been doing this, by the way, on an annual basis to look at our impact, you know, in the industry. And we are now going to be coming up with a new operational ICT system. We already have an ICT system in place. However, this is an ICT system that, you know, we took from the Microfinance Regulatory Council. At the time when the NCR was set up in 2006, the last thing that we wanted to do was to start implementing a new act and changing systems at the same time. So we tweaked what, you know, that system here and there to make sure that it worked for us. But, you know, we've been operating now for 5 years, and this is a totally new industry. There are new challenges, and therefore we have decided, you know, we need to, you know, to bring in a new system that can talk to the new processes that, you know, we did a business process reengineering, which came up with efficiencies, you know, ways of, you know, doing business efficiently. So the new ICT system is going to be talking to those processes. Challenges, delays in acquiring information, but we are looking at e-filing as one way of making sure that we don't, you know, there aren't delays in getting information from registrars. And as I said, you know, capacity issues. Remedies, the learnership program that I spoke to, initiate stronger stakeholder relations, you know, and obviously, you know, enforce the act. We need to be very, you know, forceful about that. And we need to be very aggressive. You know, we need to be seen to have, you know, to be enforcing the act. And I think what it means is that we may need to start making sure that we publicize our successes, you know, in terms of our enforcement actions. Currently investigating pilot satellite offices. And in terms of our achievements, we've always had an unqualified, you know, audit report since inception. We had a Soweto, you know, debt casting and savings outreach. As a result of the invitation that we received from Honorable Mabaso to run with that workshop for a day, and it was successful. The government employees placed this, you know, Soul City program, which is watched apparently by more than 50% of SAB viewers view Soul City program. And we work in partnership with Old Mutual and National Debt Mediation Agency in coming up with that Soul City, which has ended. We have done raids. We did raids in the Eastern Cape early this year, where some micro lenders were arrested because they were retaining people's ATM cards, taking old pensioners, you know, pension cards. We are currently busy with one now in the Northern Cape, and I was made to understand this morning that there were some micro lenders who were arrested there. And we've been doing that in partnership with, you know, with the South African police, with NPA, with SASA, with, you know, the provincial economic crime, because we really believe that the only impact that we can make as the NCR is to work in partnership with other agencies. And we'll be doing another one in the Northwest. And I spoke about the learnership program. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I will hand over to the Acting Finance Manager to quickly take you through the budget.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. My first slide is I started with budget 11-12, where we are currently, and the budget 12-13. So the first page is the budget 11-12 and 12-13. It's in a form of I use expenses as categories that summarize them as personnel, which comprises of salaries, training, you name it. Operating expenses is more on projects. Administrative is enablers, premises, telephone, so forth. So for 11-12, the personnel cost is just an increase of 4.4%. Operating is a decrease of 6%. Administrative is an increase of 6.8%. Overall, it's 0.8%. For the financial implication to strategic objective one, as my acting CEO has alluded, that we need to do the research on access to credit for historical disadvantaged persons. So we currently have two major projects. The other one is unsecured lending. We have budgeted 18.4 million. The coming year will be 19.3. 14-15 will be 20.2. Establishment of the National Credit Regulator as a register as well, where we'll be having the data management tool, we'll be getting information in a graphic, text, and table format. That will cost us 2 million for 12-13, 3.5 for 13-14. And on my right-hand side, I just explain how are we going to, in a expense format, how are we going to do those strategic objectives. 35% will be on personnel. Operating costs will be 65%. Meaning, if we engage a consultant, we make sure that at the end of the project, he has transferred the skill, because as our acting CEO has alluded that, NCR is very challenged with capacity. So we also embark on, when we get a contract, we also make sure that at the end of the contract, the skills is transferred. Hence, we also using the personnel cost as well. Strategic objective two is more on awareness. Our output, we have to make sure that there are three strategies, namely consumer rights awareness, enforcement strategy, and stakeholder are approved. The coming year we'll implement. The other head is an evaluation report and the recommendation. And we're planning to use 39.9 on 12-13, 13-14, 14.5, 14-15, 46.5. How are we going to use that? Personnel cost is going to be 84%. Administrative, we're going to use 25% of it. Why I'm saying administrative expenses also will also assist. We do have current structures that we're using, people going out, doing radio talk shows, etc. So hence we using administrative expenses in that regard, and also operating costs of 43%. Strategic objective three is more compliance. We will be using personal costs, so people are going out for make sure that we comply with the Act. In parallel to that, we also have projects like credit bureau investigations, 2 per annum. So we're planning to use 4.3 in 12-13, 15.1 in 13-14, 16 in 14-15. The last strategic objective is more on a support. It's more of enabling that people are meeting the strategic objectives. Hence, I've also, the contribution of all the costs will be administrative, 43, personnel, 23, and also operating costs, 32. There will be all the strategic objectives as well. We're having a huge project called a new operating ICT system. As my acting CEO has mentioned, that we're busy with. So we're planning to use 9 million in 12-13, 13-14, 5.7, 14-15, 3.3. The total is 39.7, 39.3, and 39.68 respectively. The overall picture from strategic objective 1 to 4, the total it will be 111 million. In 12-13, 13-14 is 119.9, 14-15 is 120.5 million. Thank you.
Honourable members, here is the presentation, which I think is so well presented. Also, the SWAT plan is very exhaustive, né? Very broad and precise. So I'll take questions from the members. First, Honorable Albert, Honorable Bernard Merle, that's it.
Thank you, Chair. It's quite disconcerting to see that the banks are now trying to get unsecured, or to give out unsecured credit to consumers. Now, obviously, we can't stop them from operating in the free market, but have you liaised with the banks in regard to this to see where this drive comes from and how it can be contained to a degree? And also, do you liaise with the Financial Services Board, who on the other hand is responsible or has a mandate for securing savings so that people are actually educated as far as savings are concerned, that this is incurring debt? And then, if you could just give some more clarity regarding the Twin Peaks, envisaged Twin Peaks legislation, and how you would actually fit into that going forward. Thank you.
Chair, thank you very much, and I'd like to thank the presenters very much, because I think actually the National Credit Regulator and indeed the Act has stood South Africa in very good stead. I mean, we clearly had a problem before the implementation of the Act and the establishment of the regulator with people and their loans. But I do think we need to be very concerned about what you've raised with us regarding unsecured loans. And I'd like to propose here that we call the bank in the form, to our committee, in the form of the banking Basaya, because I've had a personal experience, actually, about trying to get a loan for a house, a secured loan for my daughter, actually. The price they wanted to charge her to loan her the money was completely and utterly outrageous. I mean, what she would have been paying over 20 years, I understand compound interest and so on, was completely and utterly outrageous. Now, that is me, a resourced person, and my daughter, a resourced person. What about all the other people who want to get into the market, who want to buy a house, and what about the economy? And I really think we have to tackle this matter, because you said that, in fact, the banks, when you approached them on this, I think your words were, they said it was unprofitable. But the question is, what kind of a profit? You know, how big must the profit be? Because they are now making all this profit on unsecured loans, getting people into further difficulties, and I think we need to take this thing seriously. So I would like to propose that. I see that you've put here that the behavior of credit providers through its enforcement actions in the court has been successfully changed. But the major credit providers are, in fact, the banks, and I think we need to tackle this problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Slav.
Thanks, Berke. And thanks very much to the National Credit Regulator for this information, which is at the same time educative to us. I would like to start by raising with the chairperson the issue of the acting CEO and acting CFO. That the minute you introduce them as acting, I started to feel shaky. Because, acting people are never really too certain whether they will still be there at the end of the day. Maybe the board should address this matter and appoint. Either appoint them or appoint other people differently, but appoint. We can't afford acting again and again and again. I want to tell a story about the bank. And in respect to the mortgage versus the unsecured. Someone was owing the balance of 100,000, I remember, which he had to pay at 3,500 for a period of 10 years. And this person then went to another bank. I can mention the bank, there's no problem. It was Standard Bank, where the loan was, the mortgage loan. And this person went to Capitec Bank. And Capitec Bank paid off this and made him pay less than the 3,500, something like 3,200 for 5 years. Because not only is this an issue of insecurity, but it's also an issue of the management of the interest rates as decided by the bank. You get a lot of difference between the four big banks and Capitec, even in the interest rate, even in the banking system. What you can get this side and what you cannot get this side. Some financial person was saying to me, it is unlikely that Capitec will survive. And I say, I wish it must survive, because then it poses a good competition. So, coming to the issue of the slide number, page 7, let's say page 7, the bottom slide. I like it very much when NCR made reference to the financial literacy from primary level. But it fell short of addressing what I thought it was going to be. I would have thought we were going to talk about engaging the Department of Education to try and see if the curriculum and the syllabus can start including basic financial studies, you know, about what you have and what you don't have, what is the meaning of credit and so on, from primary level, so that as our children grow, they grow understanding the finances and the implications of loans from the beginning. But you made mention of you yourself getting an opportunity to address. But if you see that way, how many children are you going to reach? Very few. But if we make it something that the department must enforce in schools, it would be better. I don't know that value, it might not be a good one, but consider it. The other point, which is, I think, the last one there, is the issue relating to the overlapping of roles. I think the three entities that presented today have got overlapped. All of them. In the presentation of CICC, they raised it, that they think it is necessary. They have already started initiating discussions with consumer protection to look at how they can relate or make certain agreements in how they approach certain areas. That overlap will always be there, but it's a matter of building cooperative governance of how you handle those particular issues. Thank you.
All right, Honorable James.
Oh, I need to be excused, Chair, but I didn't want to leave without supporting the Honourable Van der Merwe's call to have a look at at the banks and the question of charges on when it comes to interest against home loans. But I also wanted to say the general question. I'm not sure we can do it at the same time. It would be very good to look at bank charges itself, because my impression is. I mean, the Ombudsman investigated insurance charges, and I think it's time we focus on banks themselves, which is in support of that.
Honourable members, I think that...
I am, and may I be excused at that time.
All right, I think, before the commission, before the regulator responded, gives the responses to that, there are certain strong proposals which are made, so I think that we must take a decision around that. It started with the Honourable Albert, the issue of the bank. The issue of the bank. He said that the regulator must engage the bank. Honourable Van der Merwe escalated that no, it must not only be the regulator. We, as the portfolio committee, we must make a follow-up around that. Also, on my question, which I was going to have here, I'm very happy that the regulator was proactive, because the issue of unsecured loans is very dangerous. We know that the recession which we had in 2007-8 started because of this type of loans which were taking place in Europe and in America. So we cannot do disservice to our people by allowing this thing to go unchallenged. So what I appeal for is one, is that let's support the proposal that let us engage the bank, but not only on the issue of the interest only,
the issue of the provision of the credit, this issue of unsecured loans. But there's also another disturbing aspect which has come out, was that the issue of the way the interest is charged. Seemingly some banks is charged racially. Even if you are in the same level, with a boss, you are an African, you are white, but at the same LSM level, your interest is not going to be the same. I think those are the things which the regulator must look upon, with a boss, because I think that our constitution enjoys us to bridge that divide. I think the other aspect, which is, let's call the banks in, let the regulator, because it's already started with this, with the research around the issue of the unsecured loans. When is that report going to be ready so that we can come and present it to the committee?
The report, Chair, is going to be ready, at least the first draft for presentation to the board by end of April.
End of April?
Yeah.
And then after the report, it can come straight to.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, because they were having an opening on the 9th of May.
Oh.
We're having an opening on the 9th of May. Yeah, yeah. So I think we'll secure that report must come back around the 9th of May.
Yes.
Now, the support, Honorable James supported Honorable Sue. Is there anyone who's got a problem with that?
No.
Of course. Not when such a latest meeting proposal that someone can go in any other direction except by saying yes. Or I think that was Honorable James. All right, I think, thanks a lot, Honorable James. I think the regulator, there are questions which get to you. Can you respond to that, please?
Thank you, Chair. The first question is around meetings with the banks. I've already alluded to the fact that we have met on a one-on-one basis because we targeted the culprits. And on a one-on-one basis, we then met with them to try and understand why it is that they're going that route. We met definitely with all the four big banks. We met with African Bank. We also met with Capitec Bank. And we met with, some of the, one or two retailers. But the issue around unsecured lending, and these are personal loans, you find that most of the credit providers that are driving that are the banks. So we had those one-on-one questions. We also had a meeting with the Banking Association of South Africa to sensitize them about our concerns. We met with the Reserve Bank, the Registrar of Banks, and that's the reason why he's also, the Registrar of Banks has also decided to do, a similar study. But we are going to be joining forces so that we don't duplicate work. We've also sensitized Treasury, and we have sort of the FBI. We'll need to schedule a meeting, and thank you for that comment. We'll need to schedule a meeting with the FSB. So that we also sensitize them around it. But fortunately, the CEO of FSB sits on our board, so he's well aware of what's happening in that space. The envisaged twin peaks, as I said, it's still work in progress. There are different committees that have been set up to look at. The one committee where NCR has been invited to sit as an observer is the one on market conduct because a lot of what we do in terms of the Act is really market conduct regulation. So they are also looking at, they are benchmarking what they would like to do in South Africa. And as I said, this is really driven by Treasury and FSB. But I'm made to understand that the two honorable ministers at the talk are talking, they are having discussions around this. So at this point in time, it's really, work in progress. And in terms of the twin peak, Treasury and FSB are looking to set up the market conduct regulator or regulators and prudential regulator. At this point in time, I've been assured that as far as the NCR is concerned, and that is for now, we don't know what's going to happen in the future, is that NCR will continue to do market conduct regulation as far as non-banks and banks are concerned. And only in terms of credit, as we've always done it. And there's also the issue, I'll leave that the chair will talk to the other issue. Let me just talk about the example that the honourable member spoke about, you know, the interest, different interest rates that are charged by banks. In terms of the Act, the Act stipulates the maximum interest rate that credit providers can charge for different types of credit products. In terms of unsecured credit, for instance, the maximum that credit providers can charge is 32% per annum. That's the maximum. It does not, however, mean that you can't charge less. In terms of mortgages, the maximum that credit providers can charge is about 17% per annum. Short-term credit is 5% per month. So, you know, it really depends on the credit product that is on offer. And the credit, Consumer Credit Act, the National Credit Act only stipulates the maximum. And, you know, hopefully, we've been hoping that, and we've actually seen that in terms of the study that we did in 2009 that we are now reviewing now, that in 2009 already we could see that in terms of the access to cost and access to finance, to credit, that there was a decline in terms of the different, you know, interest rates that banks can charge. The gentleman, the honourable member that has left, was also talking about bank charges. Now, we should understand that bank charges that are not related to the Act are not regulated by the National Credit Regulator. They don't form part of the Act. The Act only allows for three costs: interest, monthly service fees, which are 50 rand a month, and initiating fees. Those are the only three costs that are allowed, that credit providers are allowed to charge in terms of the Credit Agreement Act. So you'll find Capitec Bank, for the same amount of money, will charge a different interest rate than, you know, Standard Bank, as long as they don't charge above what is, you know, the maximum that is allowed for in the Credit Act. They are not contravening the Act. Now, the primary level of primary level, you know, literacy, I thank you for that comment of engaging the Department of Education, and yeah, we need to do that, otherwise it's going to be very difficult for us to influence, you know, the curriculum in schools. So we will do that. The overlapping of roles, already we work very closely with SIPs, because we register credit providers, credit bureaus, you know, debt counselors, and debt counselors are individuals, so we only register individuals to do debt counseling. But in as far as credit providers and credit bureaus are concerned, where they are companies, we normally have to make sure that we talk to the, you know, SIPs to find out whether they are properly registered and so forth. So we work closely together in that regard. But yeah, the overlap, as I indicated, we've already met with the Consumer, you know, Protection Commissioner to look at potential overlaps and messaging, you know, giving messages or disseminating messages to consumers. That's all for me. I will ask the chairperson perhaps to make a comment on the other issue that you raised. Thank you.
I'll really just deal with two issues, going back to the unsecured loans versus mortgage bonds. There's some very interesting developments taking place, and again, because it's a development, we're in the middle of it, and one doesn't always know the outcome of these things. But certainly from the bank's point of view on secured lending, they're saying, well, we're in a growth phase. And we've heard the statistics given to us by the acting CEO, you know, 32% over a shorter period of time, as opposed to 17 or prime plus 2 over a 20-year period. If you start to do the economics, you can begin to see what becomes more profitable. Something we also need to, just to take note of as a nation, that there are in the region of about 60,000 people who have fallen more than 3 months behind on their mortgage bonds. What's that saying to us? And suddenly we're now seeing, as a percentage, more money being lent out on consumption, on motor cars and furniture and all those sorts of things, as opposed to mortgage bonds. And certainly Basel III doesn't make it any easier. But one of the problems the banks have got is, well, there's 60,000 people who've fallen behind with their mortgage bonds. They can't we don't want to repossess because we don't want to become landlords, and then who do we sell to? So very, very interesting development, and that, of course, may well be, may well be so.
But certainly, I think that's a conversation that we need to have as a nation, and to work out where do we need to go, what do we need to do so we can come up with the right result. Certainly, I can give this committee the assurance that the National Credit Regulator will not fail in its duties in terms of asking these questions and complying with its regulatory function, the duty that that undertaking. Turning then just to the question of the acting. Insofar as the acting CEO is concerned, we're simply awaiting a confirmation there from the minister. Obviously, there's certain procedures that need to be followed. In the interim, the acting CEO has the full backing of the board, and we work closely with each other, but obviously we would welcome a permanent appointment subject to the proper procedures being followed. Insofar as the acting financial manager being here, it's probably at this point incumbent on me to place the following on record before the committee. Is that on the 30th of January this year, I received an email making certain allegations against certain employees, more specifically the chief financial officer. Flowing out of that, within 2 days, we'd commissioned an independent forensic company in the form of Ernst & Young, who are currently conducting an investigation into what I must stress at this point are purely allegations. The chief financial officer and one or two other people were not originally placed on special leave. It was subsequent information that came from my knowledge, and then based on that, certain individuals, including the chief financial officer, have been placed on special leave. That investigation is almost at an end. We await the report from Ernst & Young. And once we get it, we will study it, we will act upon it, and take the appropriate steps. And from the board's point of view, we believe that we are thoroughly in control of the situation, and we will just take the appropriate steps when we need to. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for the responses you have given to this committee. But also appreciate your first to make a speech in the Portfolio Committee as the chair, Mr. Bailey. Very incisive man. We wish you and your team all of the best as we charter this very stormy water of credit. That's why that we are looking forward to the date of the 9th, where we request you to come in with that report. But at the same time, we also request the BASA, Banking Land of Association of South Africa, so that you must come, so that we take really this thing once and for all. Because it is in our interest that we defend the future of this country by ensuring that its economy is strong. And then it can only be strong if we've got proper research information out there so that when the people take decisions, they take decisions from an informed position. And also deal with this issue of the historical divide. I think that you've got a lot to do. I think that the challenges which you raise, the committee is going to take them into consideration and then take appropriate steps as it moves. Thanks a lot for the wonderful job you have done, you are doing, and then all of the best, because we need to make South Africa to work. Also, thanks the DTI for being supportive for our entities, because without you, they are executing no mandate. There's one thing which I like with all the entities today. They've linked their objectives direct to the objectives of the DTI. They were able to link that. I think that one specifically shows that the center is holding. So I think that as we move forward, please engage them, take them by hand if necessary. Because at the end of the day, it's you who are going to blame if things don't go according to plan. Thanks a lot. All of you members, we are about to go to a very short constituency. We know that we are going to do a lot of work. Although we are already tired, but we have to outdo ourselves again. You know, I've got an NEC member here. She's so hawkish. You know, she smiles there, typically inside the committee, but when she goes outside, the work which comes from their side is worse than what we're having here. But honorable members, really, I do appreciate your input for today and the work you've done for the people of the Republic, because it's only through you that we can make this country to work. You could see that, you could have seen that the minutes were distributed. We're not going to consider them today. It's for you to look at them. You also seen that the draft program was was distributed, the draft program of the committee was distributed to. The only confirmed date is that one of the 9. That one is unshakable. The others can move, but that one of the National Credit Regulator at BASA for the 9th is a fact. They must be here. And then you also see that there's a strat plan. The strat plan, which was also distributed, the strat plan is for you to comment, so that at least by the time you come back, we know that what input you want to prioritize for the next step. So, but we know that we love our country. We make those inputs and make South Africa to work. Thank you, each and every one of us. Amanda.